Excuse me, young brother. May we ask you a question?
Are you threatening me? We'll ask the questions. Why do I not use pee-pee for my pee-pee? You will be loved. For I am the great Cornholio. I need pee-pee for my bunghole.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of...
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to dote?
Woo! Will you be my Valentine? This is the Valentine's Day episode of the Sound Off here, Solo Monster Sounds Off, episode 691, for Sunday, February 14, 2021. You know what would be a great Valentine's gift? The gift of Amazon Music. I'm so happy to bring this to you guys, partnering up with Amazon Music to offer a free 30-day trial of the service when you use our new link. GetAmazonMusic.com/Solomonster. Because I subscribe to a whole bunch of different services. I've got Pandora, I've got Spotify, I've got Amazon Music Unlimited. And you can actually listen to the podcast on there as well. But there's, you know, all the music and playlists and stuff that they're more known for, even more so than the podcast. You can get it free for 30 days. You could try it out using our link. So I hope you guys will take advantage of this offer. I want to show them the power of the Sound Off Army. So get AmazonMusic.com/Solomonster. You get 30 days of the service free on me when you use that link. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. And if you have something to promote or plug, you want to inquire about an ad, get in touch soon because the calendar is filling up fast. I want to say thank you to Killshot, Keith Hart, shout out to him and his niece, adorable Lila Strubel, who came into the world this past Tuesday. We have a new Sound Off fan. Take No Prisoners, Tamara Davis, Night Stalker Nayef Alsafar, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, the Firebomber, Craig Foster, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Ostentatious Alan Carter, the 90s Vampire, Eddie Valens, Dark Sky, Dixon Krasinski, the Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, the Alabama Assassin, Chris Young, and of course, Belt Fan Brent Banner. Check out his How Did We Even Get Here podcast, talking pro wrestling and other topics, available on all major platforms and on YouTube at tinyurl.com/getheretube. And also check out the video that Brent did with his best friend, former indie wrestler Kyle Webb, where they each break down their top five wrestling bromances. 40 minutes worth of content there in that video. You can find that on YouTube as well. At tinyurl.com/WWE bromance. And Adam from FWCI. Shout out to Adam. He breaks down the big news from the world of wrestling each week, and he pays close attention to the Aussie talent on his show, World Wrestling Straya on YouTube. But this week he's talking about a whole bunch of different things. Shaq in AEW, Bow Wow in WWE. All of his regular segments, better than Baron Corbin. Well, what's not better than, Baron Corbin? I mean, come on. He also posted a first-time reaction video to the top 10 Super Bowl plays of all time. And he says that John Diesel Riggins is an absolute machine. Follow him on Twitter at FWCIE and subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/FWCIETC to support the channel and help him reach 1,000 subscribers. Some programming notes for the week ahead in wrestling, and then I am going to get into this Tom Cole stuff a little bit, because that was a sad thing to read about this week. Got a bunch of thoughts about Raw and SmackDown, and more history for you as we do every week. But some programming notes first. Monday night at 7 Eastern on their YouTube channel, AEW will air the first round matches from the Japanese side of the bracket in their Women's Eliminator Tournament to crown a number one contender for Hikaru Shida's Women's Championship. Yuka Sakazaki takes on Mei Tsuruga. Veni takes on Emi Sakura. Maki Ito faces Ryo Mizunami. And Aja Kong, there's a name from the past right there. Aja Kong, most devastating spinning backfist I've ever seen, battles Rin Katakura. And I said on the Dynamite stream on Wednesday night, Britt Baker is my pick to win the entire tournament. She's on the other side of the bracket on the U.S. side. She's my pick to win the whole thing. I think it comes down to either Baker and Maki Ito in the finals or Baker against Yuka Sakazaki, who we've seen on AEW television before pre-pandemic. That Dynamite main event on Wednesday night to close out the show with Moxley and Archer against Kenny Omega and Kenta making his in-ring AEW debut, that was pure chaos. Chaotic main event. If you love those kinds of matches, falls count anywhere, just brawling all over the building, you'll love this match. I thought this was one of the best Dynamite main events that we've had to date on the show. So if you missed it, go back and watch it. I think you'll enjoy it. All 10 episodes of New Japan Pro Wrestling Season 1 are now available on the Roku channel, free in the US, UK, and Canada. You can watch them on the RokuChannel.com even without an account. So if you don't want to sign up for an account, you can still get access to the shows. This week, they're all on demand now, but episode 2, technically this Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern, is going to air. It is the IWGP title match between Okada and Ibushi from night 1 of Wrestle Kingdom 14 last year in the Tokyo Dome. So that is your New Japan programming update. Speaking of New Japan, at the end of last night's Impact No Surrender pay-per-view, which saw the Good Brothers, Karl Anderson and Luke Gallows, retain their Impact Tag Team titles over Private Party and Beer Guns, the team of Chris Sabin and James Storm. After that pay-per-view was over last night, a video aired, a video teasing the Impact debut this week coming up of Finn Juice, David Finlay, and Juice Robinson from New Japan Pro Wrestling, who will be appearing in the Impact Zone this Tuesday. Now, Robinson has been out with a fractured orbital bone since the end of December. He missed the Tokyo Dome. He was supposed to wrestle, I believe, Kenta for the briefcase and couldn't do it. Now, according to PW Insider, this announcement, because you would think, you know, the timing of it, well, this must have something to do with what's going on with AEW and all this talk about doors and forbidden doors. But according to PW Insider, this announcement has nothing at all to do with the AEW relationship with New Japan. This deal was made prior to that, and really it dates back to last summer when Anderson and Gallows signed with Impact. New Japan wanted to use them. They wanted to work again for New Japan. And, you know, some of these guys have the ability to, on the side, make their own deals if they want to go work with New Japan. I think John Moxley has that kind of deal. But that's really where the genesis of this was, because New Japan wanted to use them as well. And I guess a dialogue at that point started between the two companies. I know Chris Bay, I had mentioned that on the podcast at the time. He was part of the Super J Cup tournament you know, a few months ago. It's a big deal for Impact because they have tried for years, and I do mean years, to mend the broken fences, to mend the relationship between themselves and New Japan. There were a lot of bad feelings on the New Japan side over a lot of things dating back many years ago, even to the time that Okada was on excursion in TNA. And they were not happy with how he was used. He had 18 matches in TNA with a record of 2-16. And the way he was portrayed on television. Now, Okada has spoken mostly positively of his experience there and you know, just the things he learned and how it was a good learning experience for him. But I get the sense New Japan was not exactly thrilled with the way in which he was portrayed. And yeah, this was during the Russo era of TNA. So, you know, how much of that was him and his, I would say, dislike probably for foreign talent. And based on his own comments in the past, which I won't repeat here, I think we know how he feels about that. But there were other incidents as well. There was an IWGP tag team title change on a TNA show back in 2009. That I don't know if it was a matter of just a miscommunication between the two companies or exactly what it was. Team 3D were the champions. They dropped the belts to the British Invasion. You know, a title change that New Japan initially did not sanction. So again, was it just a loss of communication in there somewhere? Or was TNA really that stupid enough to book a title change for another promotion's titles without getting their approval first? I know this is TNA, old school TNA we're talking about here, so the answer to that is probably yes. They were very stupid, made a lot of stupid decisions at various points in their existence. And then there was the first time that Jeff Hardy made an ass out of himself in a TNA World title match. He defended the TNA World Championship against Tetsuya Naito at Wrestle Kingdom 5 in the Tokyo Dome. 2 months before that disaster of a main event of Victory Road that Jeff Hardy had with Sting, which I've talked about. I think we all remember what happened there. This was 2 months before that, and he showed up for this match with Naito. All you got to do is watch it. Showed up completely fucked up. They had a horrible match. So there were a lot of issues there. And when Anthem bought the company, Scott D'Amore, who works behind the scenes for Impact, he visited Japan, and on his visit to Japan, he addressed the locker room. He made a speech of sorts to the locker room at one of the shows in the back and apologized. He apologized for all of the past issues with the previous administrations, the previous regimes, under all the other people. And it has taken this long to get these two back working together again. So for Impact, they've been waiting a very long time for this. And this is going to be the beginning, I guess, of whatever this working relationship is going to look like. It starts this Tuesday with Finlay and Robinson appearing on Impact Television. Now, also on Tuesday night, Young Rock premieres at 8 Eastern on NBC. This is a new autobiographical sitcom that was created by or co-created by Dwayne Johnson that chronicles his life. They have three different actors portraying The Rock from three different ages, age 10, age 15, and then I think it's age 18 to 20, chronicling different parts of his life and his family's history in the professional wrestling business. We learned this week, and in fact, we learned yesterday, the names of the people that have been cast to play the Macho Man Randy Savage and Vince McMahon. Savage is going to be played by Kevin Makeley, who starred in the 2019 Western Badland. And if you look at a picture of him, he does bear a resemblance facially to Randy Savage. Although I've seen Savage impersonators who are dead ringers for him, but probably can't act worth a shit. You do have to find somebody with some acting skills. So he's pretty good. I think he's a pretty good casting based on what I'm seeing. And playing the role of Vincent Kennedy McMahon will be comedian Adam Ray, who, when you look at a picture of him, does not look anything like Vince McMahon. But, you know, now there's pictures out there of him dressed in the suit with the hairdo like Vince. And I guess I could see it a little bit, you know, maybe a little bit. They also have actors playing Andre the Giant, Rocky Johnson, the Iron Sheik, Junkyard Dog, and the Wild Samoans. So that premieres Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Saturday, February 20th, Progress Wrestling's first show in nearly one full year, Chapter 104, Natural Progression, will stream on the WWE Network at 3 p.m. Eastern. The description says, Chapter 104 will see the start of the 7th Natural Progression Series tournament, which gives the future stars of British wrestling the opportunity to break out on the biggest stage possible. Participants in previous editions of the tournament include Pete Dunne, Zach Gibson, Eddie Dennis, Tyler Bate, and Flash Morgan Webster, among others. Past winners of the tournament include Mark Andrews, who used his victory to become Progress champion, and Toni Storm, who became the first ever Progress women's champion by winning the fourth edition. Chapter 105, Bring the Thunder, will debut 1 week later, which will include the end of the Natural Progression series and the first ever female Thunder Bastard match. What a great fucking name. The Thunder Bastard match. Apparently, it's similar to a Royal Rumble match with a new competitor entering every 2 minutes and wrestlers can be eliminated by pinfall, submission, or disqualification. It was not a good year for British wrestling with the COVID shutdowns and then all of the speaking out allegations. The company, after all that, rebooted and it relaunched with a new management team after the speaking out stuff in particular. And they have new measures in place now to try to provide what they say for a safer working environment. For their sake and their own future, they better hope that's the case. I wasn't sure too many of these promotions were even going to survive all of that. But all the names that were coming out every single week. So this is part of their big reboot, and it'll be airing on the WWE Network. And also airing on the WWE Network next Sunday is the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view. And I'm going to be doing my predictions for that later this week, probably on YouTube. And then I'll be live with you on YouTube again next Sunday after it ends. So you're getting back-to-back double podcast Sundays, including today. Now, why is that? Because tonight is NXT TakeOver Vengeance Day. And I'll be live on YouTube with a full recap after the show is over. We now have the finals set up tonight for the men's and women's Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic. MSK, the former Rascals, beat Legado del Fantasma on Wednesday to advance to the finals, where they will meet the Grizzled Young Veterans, who beat Tommaso Ciampa and Timothy Thatcher to advance. Ciampa and Thatcher, they were my original pick, before they got inserted into the tournament late, were the Grizzled Young Vets. So I'm going to just revert back to my original pick, I guess. Only because they got to the end last time and they fell short. And so this time I think they win the whole thing. So they're my pick to win. On the women's side, Shotzi Blackheart and Ember Moon beat Candice LeRae and Indy Hartwell to advance to the finals to meet Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez. Kai and Gonzalez were my pick to win. But I don't think that MSK is winning the men's cup. And since I think we're going to get one heel win in this tournament, or in these tournaments, one heel win and one babyface win, then I'm going to go with the babyfaces here to then go on to challenge the Holy One and Shayna Baszler for the women's tag team titles. And so I'm going to pick Shotzi Blackheart and Ember Moon. I'm changing my final pick here. I'm going with the babyfaces. And also, you know, for another reason, not just that, but for this reason as well, I think Raquel Gonzalez is being groomed for something bigger at the next TakeOver show, which I'm going to talk about here. Io Shirai defending her NXT Women's Championship tonight, triple threat match against Toni Storm, Mercedes Martinez. I don't see Mercedes Martinez as somebody who's going to carry the title. I think she's going to end up being that great star on the brand who can sort of go in there. She's the veteran who's been doing this for 20 years. She can have very good matches. She can work with anybody, especially people on the way up. But I don't see her as being the one they build around. I don't see her as, unless it's a transitional role to get the belt off of one babyface and then immediately onto another a month later. She could be the Iron Sheik of the women's division. But short of that, I don't see her as being that person that they put the title on and really build around. I mean, of the two challengers in this match, if anybody was going to win it, it would be Toni Storm. But I don't think either of them win the title. I have Io Shirai pegged to retain the championship. And she retains largely because I think the match they're building to is Io defending and dropping the title to Raquel Gonzalez at the next TakeOver show. Don't forget, Raquel Gonzalez pinned Io Shirai in the War Games match to win the match for her team. She pinned the champion. And that was never followed up on. I think Io keeps the belt because the biggest match is the one that hasn't happened yet, and the time is not right just yet. Io's had the belt for a while. I think she's approaching the end of her run soon, but I still think that's a couple of months away. Johnny Gargano defends the North American Championship against the most protected man in all of NXT, Kushida. I think they were protecting Kushida in the fall, which is when his push really started, protecting him for an NXT title match with Finn Balor. I think the two were even teasing it on Twitter at the time. And then Balor got hurt. He got his jaw broken in two places. And I think they didn't know when he was going to be coming back. They didn't know how long he would be out for. And they didn't know what to do with Kushida in the interim. So he sort of coasted for a while, but he kept racking up wins when we would see him on TV. He was winning all of his matches. He was beating the hell out of the Velveteen Dream until he transitioned into this feud here with Gargano. The last shot of him that we had on NXT television on Wednesday was of Kushida posing over Gargano while Dexter Lumis was putting Austin Theory to sleep. So I predict that Gargano retains. I think Lumis may be involved. He may inadvertently play a role in Kushida losing, but I don't think Gargano is dropping the title just yet. And Finn Balor defends the NXT Championship against Pete Dunne. I've been looking forward to this for a while now. This is going to be great. I don't think Balor drops the belt this close to WrestleMania. There are rumors of there being an NXT Championship match possibly added to one of the two nights this year of WrestleMania. And look, if that happens, I think the match is Finn Balor defending against Karrion Kross, who, as I predicted last week, is wrestling Santos Escobar not tonight, but I thought they would probably save the match for TV on Wednesday, and that is what they are doing. And I think, more than anything, they like keeping these takeover shows to a tight five matches. There might have been a few in the past that went to six, but there's a formula here that works. You know, NXT does not run very long. You know, the show tonight probably will go 2.5 hours or so. They usually keep it tight to a five-match card. And why not just save this match as one of your main events for TV on Wednesday? So they've already announced that match, Karrion Kross against Escobar. Obviously, it's non-title. Karrion Kross is not competing for the Cruiserweight Championship. But that's going to be a very unique match. I don't know. Kross is in this weird realm where I don't know if he's necessarily a heel. He's definitely not a babyface. He could be somewhere in between. He is, to me, he comes away as more heel than babyface. Escobar is a heel. But these two have worked together before, I believe, or worked together in Mexico. I'm very curious to see what kind of match they put together. I have yet to be blown away by any carrying. I like Karrion Kross, too. He carries himself like a superstar. Having that entrance doesn't hurt. Having Scarlett doesn't hurt. And I think when he eventually does get the call up, they're going to make a big deal about this guy. And really, he'll have the elaborate entrance. And, you know, he'll be, I think at least initially, he'll be taken care of. But, you know, he hasn't had that one big match yet. That one big breakout performance. And that could come in the match next week. This Wednesday, I should say, with Escobar. But it will not be happening tonight on the TakeOver show. Cameron Grimes, I just want to mention this. He's not on the card tonight either in a match, but he is back. He was out. I think he had some minor knee surgery, I believe. But he made his return on NXT this past week. He is a rich man now. He got in on that GameStop rally, and he is rolling in the dough. So this is his new character, his new gimmick now. He's got more money than he knows what to do with. He's throwing $100 bills around. I don't know who he feuds with next. You know, the stuff with Dexter Lumis has already been done. I guess, you know, you got the members of Undisputed Era. You've got Cole. You've got Kyle O'Reilly. He can be maybe slotted up with one of them. So I don't know. I don't know what direction they're going in with him as far as this new character is concerned. But I'm just happy to have him back on the show. Right? Some people, they turn me into a fan of their work. Cameron Grimes is one of those people who at first, you know, he was having great matches. You know, his talent in the ring and what he's able to do has never been denied. But he was a total channel changer. Whenever I would hear his music hit, I was like, oh boy. And as he has really dove into this, he goes totally over the top with it. So I could see where that might be a turnoff for some people who don't like the comedy shit, but he does a tremendous job with it. I find him incredibly entertaining. I turned a page on him a long time ago, so I'd like to see him actually doing something. And maybe that's, you know, the North America. I could easily see him with that North American title at some point this year. Somebody will have to beat Johnny for it, and then he'll have to beat them for it. But before this year is out, I think North American champion Cameron Grimes could be, absolutely could become something of a reality, and something I think that could be entertaining on TV. So join me live tonight after TakeOver. We'll talk all about the show, go through all of your questions and super chats and all that fun stuff. Unfortunately, this next story is not exactly fun at all. This is the complete opposite of fun stuff. Tom Cole committed suicide this week at the age of 50, according to a person on Twitter claiming to be his brother, Lee Cole. Tom Cole is a name you may or may not have heard before. I'm sure over the course of all the shows I've done over all these almost 14 years now, I have talked about the WWE scandals, whether it's the steroid scandal, the sex scandals of the early 90s. I'm sure his name has come up. I don't know that I've ever gone into any kind of detail about him specifically. But Tom Cole worked as a ring boy for WWE. He had a couple of different stints working for the company as a young man, and claimed that he was sexually harassed and molested by former WWE employees Mel Phillips and Terry Garvin. He also mentioned Pat Patterson's name in that Patterson once, when he was either 15 or 16, grabbed his ass, but there was never anything physical with Patterson beyond that. He said Patterson would make sexual gestures and, you know, look at his crotch and lick his lips and stuff like that, which is horrendous enough. But the really serious allegations were levied against Mel Phillips and Terry Garvin. But this is what Lee Cole tweeted. Said, "My brother Tom committed suicide a couple of hours ago. Vince McMahon and his wife Linda let child molesters into their companies years ago and did everything possible to cover up what they did to my brother. I hope you can sleep good at night, Vince. Our family suffers. My brother is gone because of the guilt and shame that the WWE caused him. He asked Jerry McDevitt, counsel for WWE, to help him with therapy. He said no. Shame on you. My brother was a good man, a good father, until the pain was too much to bear. Remember, this company, WWE, would take underage children across state lines. He was the perfect victim, father not around, alcoholic mother. These men knew what to look for." Mel Phillips was a ring announcer for many years, from the mid-80s into the early 90s, off and on. He was a ring announcer for WWE. According to an interview that Tom Cole did in 1999 with Wrestling Perspectives, and you can find the full interview or at least part one of it online if you want to read it. He was 11 or 12 years old when Phillips, who also headed the WWE ring crew, saw him at a gym. He used to help clean up at a weightlifting gym. Maybe that was his earliest job. And Phillips saw him. They started talking. Found out he was a big wrestling fan. And Phillips invited him to attend a WWF show. And he offered to pick him up at his home. You know, with his parents' permission, of course. He offered to pick him up from his home and take him to the show. And that's really how he first got involved with the company. That was his entry, effectively, into the world of WWE. This was in 1985, and Phillips would drive around a whole crew of ring boys, all teenagers, to the shows. He was their driver. Cole said, again, just like Lee Cole said in his tweets, Tom Cole said the same thing back in 99 here in this interview. His mother was a raging alcoholic. His father was never around. He was out of the picture. And so he made for the perfect target. And the thing with Mel Phillips is that he had a foot fetish, and he had a habit, which, hey, you know, if you were to say that somebody had, you know, a foot fetish, that's one thing. But what made this sickening is the fact that he was known to have a habit of playing with the feet of young boys, of underage kids. Cole did not realize exactly how weird it was until he was a little bit older and then recognized what Phillips had done. Maybe was still doing at that point, but as he got older, he realized this is, you know, he learned about what foot fetishes are and stuff and how, you know, this is not right. This is just, this is too bizarre. Because, you know, stories about Phillips, he would be wrestling around with some of these kids, maybe like in a playful way, which is weird enough, but he would be wrestling around with them and then he would pull off their socks and he would play with their toes. This was not a secret that Mel Phillips would do stuff like this. Gorillamons, and I love Gorilla Monsoon. You know, look, I grew up, I mean, my God, on Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan and Vince McMahon on commentary and all this stuff, right? That was the time period of wrestling that I grew up watching. So I look back very fondly on all of those old shows and all of those old personalities. But, you know, Gorilla Monsoon would sometimes make a foot fetish crack on the air about Phillips on TV. He'll say, you know, he would say stuff like, oh, you know, he'll knock your socks off and stuff like that. Look, he would make cracks about Pat Patterson and Terry Garvin sometimes. He talked about the Terry Garvin School of Self-Defense. Garvin worked behind the scenes, and he's the one who Cole later accused of taking him back to his home one time while Garvin's wife and kids were out of town. He's a married man. He had kids. Family was out of town. Garvin took him back to his home. Cole alleged that he put on a pornographic movie and offered to perform oral sex on him, and Cole said no. He turned down his advances, ended up sleeping outside, I think, in a van or something, and then the very next day, he lost his job working in a warehouse for WWE. I mean, they openly joked about these people on TV, but they were, at the time, they were inside jokes, so nobody knew what the hell they were talking about. So even now, if you go back on the network, on their own network, and you watch some of these old syndicated shows or the primetime wrestling shows, I mean, it's all there. A lot of that stuff hasn't been edited out. It's still there. So this was not some big secret, or if anything, it was an open secret, but people knew that stuff like this was going on, or there were stories, at least, that stuff like this was going on, and they were making light of it. Look, there's an old episode of Superstars that somebody had uploaded. I just saw it again recently. Old episode of Superstars from like 1990 or 1991 during Jimmy Snuka's second run with the company when they brought him back and he was all jacked up. And it was Vince McMahon, Roddy Piper, and Jimmy Hart on commentary. And Piper, during the course of Snuka's squash match, he's asking Jimmy Hart, he goes, how come you don't manage Jimmy Snuka? And Jimmy Hart says, oh, well, you know, he lacks that killer instinct. And you can hear Piper laughing in the background, and Vince McMahon goes, you know, what? He goes, killer instinct is the one thing that Snuka does have. I mean, this type of shit went on all the time. But Garvin had a lot of accusations levied against him, and when the company let him go, they never did bring him back. And he died, I think it was from cancer, in 1998. In the interview with Wrestling Perspectives, Cole said that he never really told anyone what happened to him, never talked about it until later. This is what he said. He said, I never really told anybody what happened to me, why I didn't get the job except my sister. That was pretty much it. I didn't tell anybody else. My brother was reading the New York Post, and he says to me, this is in the summer of 1991, whatever happened to that job you had with the WWF? I was 20 at the time. He goes, what happened? And I was like, ah, nothing. I don't want to talk about it. He said, what do you mean you don't want to talk about it? Look, they've got all this steroid shit about them in the paper. That company is in trouble. And I'm like, ah, that's nothing. Steroids. And he goes, what do you mean? So I told him the whole story. And his brother goes, holy shit. Why didn't you tell somebody sooner or tell me? I was like, it's not really something I wanted to talk about. It's something I wanted to forget about. I was pretty much heartbroken that I didn't have something that I loved. Basically, he loved that job. And he was devastated that he didn't have the job anymore. And he says his brother said to him, well, why don't I call Phil Mushnick? Now, Phil Mushnick was a reporter at the time in the New York Post. He was the one who was covering all the salacious WWF stuff. Phil Mushnick did not and does not. Like Vince McMahon, it's always been a very adversarial relationship between them. Vince McMahon, very famously in the mid-90s, once went on Superstars, I think it was. And it might have only been in the New York market. So I remember seeing it, and I didn't know what the fuck he was talking about, but he did this whole set. It must have been 5 or 10 minutes long. Vince in that studio, you know, sometimes Mean Gene or Lord Alfred Hayes would be, I don't know if it was in the studio or the truck or where they were. You would see all the screens in the background, and they would be doing a report on something. Well, there's Vince, and he spent 10 minutes talking about the steroid trial and these attorneys and Phil Mushnick. It was ridiculous. So they've always hated each other. So anyway, that's the name Phil Mushnick for those who don't know what the brother was talking about. So the brother says to Tom Cole, why don't I call Phil Mushnick? And he says, I was like, oh, I don't care. Do whatever you want. And the brother said, look, if I call Phil Mushnick and I get him to talk, will you talk to him? And Tom Cole said, yeah, but he didn't think Mushnick was going to call back. He says maybe 2 weeks later, he's at work. And his brother calls him and goes, you're never going to believe who called me today. Phil Mushnick. And he wants to talk to you about what happened. And that's initially how all of this went public. It was really his brother who went to Mushnick. And he was also the one later on who encouraged, Tom Cole to sue the company, to find a lawyer and file a lawsuit against the company. Which he was in the process of doing when he reached a settlement with WWE to get his job back. He got 2 years of back pay that I believe was said to be somewhere around $70,000. And the promise that Mel Phillips and Terry Garvin would never again be employed by the WWF. Because they had been fired. Pat Patterson, they never really got rid of Pat Patterson. I mean, they said at first that all three were gone. It would never be back. There's a lot of people that don't believe Patterson was ever really fired. He just was sort of laying low for a while. And he got brought back to the company fairly quickly. What he wanted more than anything else, Cole, was just to get his job back. He loved pro wrestling. And outside of all the salacious stuff, he says it had been a dream of his to work for WWE. And he was devastated when he lost that opportunity. The timing of the settlement is very interesting because it came right before that infamous taping of the Phil Donahue show where they talked about the WWF steroid scandal, the sex scandals. It was just a full hour of all of these people on stage. Vince McMahon was on the show, famously sitting right next to Vince McMahon was Dave Meltzer and his mullet, his glorious mullet at that time. Vince looked like he would rather be anywhere else in the world. But on that stage, talking about this stuff, sitting next to Meltzer, you know, who he used to talk to at that time. He talked to Wade Keller of The Torch as well. This is when Vince McMahon was a lot more open with at least communicating with the newsletters. But here's Vince McMahon, right? You know, everybody's ganging up on him. They're talking about this awful stuff in terms of the sex stuff, the steroid stuff. You got Meltzer next to him. At the very end of the row, he's got Bruno Sammartino, who by that point was also his mortal enemy and hated his guts. Superstar Billy Graham was there. You had Barry O on the other side. Barry Orton, who was Randy Orton's, I think, uncle, who had his own allegations levied against Terry Garvin and stuff that he alleges happened to him. So this was just a complete, it was like a total clown show when you think of it's like a circus. It's really what it was. It was like one giant circus. But the settlement came right before the taping. And Cole was invited to attend the taping and be in the audience with Linda McMahon and Miss Elizabeth, who I guess she was there as a friend of Linda's. It's kind of odd. I remember watching the episode. And even if you go watch it now, it's up on YouTube. There is one point during the episode where the camera very quickly cuts to the audience and shows Elizabeth. And I just remember the first time I saw that thinking, what the hell is she doing there? It wasn't even like she was sitting there like with Randy, like some of the wrestlers were there. Like, no, it's just there's Elizabeth just kind of sitting in the crowd and watching, which was kind of strange. But their hope Vince and Linda's hope was that somebody at some point during that episode, during that taping, would bring up the name Tom Cole. And that would be their in. It's almost like their cue to mention him and the fact that, oh, as a matter of fact, Tom Cole is here today. And we, you know, we've reached a settlement with him and he's back working for the company. And it was going to be this big triumphant thing that they could announce and reveal to the world on the show. The problem is nobody ever brought up the name Tom Cole. So Vince McMahon was deprived of his big moment. But this is what Cole said about that whole situation. He said, I stayed in the Sheraton Inn in Stamford for the whole week. Linda McMahon, said to me, look, we're going to send a car for you so that you can go shopping. I'm sending $5,000 over so you can get clothes and whatever you need and blah, blah, blah. So I went and I did that. And then she said, I guess the next day, I remember getting the phone call from her. She said, listen, Tom, there's a show coming up tomorrow. Phil Donahue. I would be honored. And he says, I can't believe I believe this shit now that I look back on it. But he says that she said, I would be honored if you would be there with me. And Tom Cole said, sure, no problem. But Cole's settlement included the company paying for his college education. He said, though, that after everything he went through, he had a lot of trouble concentrating. His grades suffered. He just did not do well. He did not do well in college. All he wanted to do was just work for the company. That's really all he wanted to do. He said Linda McMahon told him, no, you have to stay in school. And when his grades didn't improve, they let him go. And he went on unemployment. He claimed that the company challenged it 5 or 6 times. They lost every single appeal, including one time when Linda actually attended one of the hearings in person and was very upset with him sharing details about his harassment and, you know, the molestation and everything that he accused them of being part of at that time. But in the interview, when asked about Vince McMahon, what do you think about Vince McMahon, if, you know, after all these years? And again, this was back in 1999 when he did this interview. He said of Vince McMahon, he said that he is manipulative, he is conniving, and he is ruthless. Not a nice person. Of Linda McMahon, he said that it was more disappointment than anything else. He was disappointed. He was disappointed in everything they promised him, everything they promised to do, but didn't do. But he couldn't have been too upset with Linda McMahon, at least not in the last decade or so, because according to Meltzer, Tom Cole actually donated to her first Senate campaign. I don't know about her second one, but he donated, I don't know how much, to her first campaign. And when there were reporters reaching out to him trying to dig up dirt, you know, from all the stuff back in the early 90s, and they wanted him to go on the record and come out and say stuff about Linda McMahon and her involvement and all that, he refused. He refused to talk to any of them. He refused to engage with any of them. Clearly, some bad things happened to this guy when he was younger. There was a lot of disgusting behavior that went on, I'm sure, behind the scenes in that company at that time. It's been well documented. I mean, go read David Bixenspan's story on Mel Phillips on the Business Insider website that he put up last October. It'll make your skin crawl, but there's a lot of details and good information in there. But just read up on that. Read up about what Vince and Linda McMahon did and did not know about Mel Phillips and the kind of shady character that he was, and what their alleged caveat was in bringing him back to the company after initially letting him go. They had let him go once before for at least a period of a few months in the late 80s. I think it might have been around 88, because there were certain things that they had heard or they had become aware of as far as his unnatural relationship with children. But they brought him back to the company. As far as, you know, telling him, hey, this time, you know, stay away from kids. I mean, you got to read up on this stuff because there's a lot more to it than I can even cover here. Why would you employ someone like that again if you suspected that that type of behavior was going on? You're talking about kids here. It's just ridiculous, the stuff that was going on back then. You know, did all of that play a role? I mean, Lee Cole seems to think so based on his tweets, but did all of that play a role in this man's suicide after all these years? I don't know him, so I can't say. He's kind of been hidden away for all these years. Wasn't exactly a public figure. But something was obviously troubling him for him to go ahead and take his own life. And it's just the end of a very, very sad story. One that I would like to see tackled in great detail on a future episode. You could probably do a double episode on this whole story on Dark Side of the Ring. The only problem I see is not being able to interview enough of the key players for what they would probably want for an episode. A lot of them aren't around anymore. A lot of them have passed away. And even the ones who are still around, I doubt you're going to be able to get them to go on camera and talk about it, right? You're not going to get Vince or Linda McMahon. We know that. You're not getting Pat Patterson or Terry Garvin or Mel Phillips, who I think has also since passed away. You know, Tom Cole just passed away. A lot of the wrestlers from that time, they're obviously not around anymore. You can probably get Dave Meltzer, Phil Mushnick, and Barry O. And that's going to be about it. But I do think that would be a story that would be perfect to dive into on a future episode of that series if they really wanted to. The two Elimination Chamber matches this year have been set. One for Raw, one for SmackDown. Both men's matches. There will be no Women's Chamber this year. It doesn't look like, you know, whatever. I'm indifferent towards the whole thing. On Raw, they trotted out Shane McMahon. His first appearance since the demise of Raw Underground with Adam Pearce to make the announcement of the Raw Elimination Chamber match with Drew McIntyre defending the WWE Championship against Sheamus, AJ Styles, Randy Orton, Jeff Hardy, and The Miz. All current or former WWE champions. McIntyre confronted Shane in the back when Shane was going to leave. He was very confused as he thought that he was going to have a one-on-one match with Sheamus. And Shane said, well, we got to give the people the biggest main event possible. Which begs the question then, why is The Miz in there if you want to give people the biggest main event possible? So here's a few things on this. I don't know what the point of having Shane McMahon on the show was since he immediately left the building after the opening segment. They didn't promote his appearance at all. So people would not have even known that he was going to be on the show. And then as soon as he showed up, he was gone. The only thing that makes sense is that his appearance was the first in a line of appearances that are now planned to get him back involved in some way on TV, and that he's the one who's going to end up challenging Drew for the WWE title. And I hope I'm not willing that into existence just by mentioning it, but it was admit it. It was a thought that did occur to you. When you saw Shane and you saw him and Drew face-to-face backstage, it was a thought that at least occurred to you briefly in your brain. Otherwise, there was no need for him to be there. But it is also ridiculous for Jeff Hardy and The Miz to be in the chamber at all. The Miz has the Money in the Bank briefcase. That is the only thing that he has going for him. Jeff Hardy has been losing nearly all of his matches. He lost another one-on-one here on this show to AJ Styles. You know, in these matches like this, they build in these little in-match injuries. They did it with Jeff. They did it with Charlotte Flair. They do it with her sometimes. They build in these little in-match injuries as a way to protect them. Because they're so afraid sometimes to actually let someone else get over and get a clean win over somebody. Well, you know, they lost, but, you know, their shoulder was hurt or their knee was hurt or they stubbed their fucking toe, whatever it was. Here it was Jeff Hardy's knee. A loss is a loss. The only person he can beat lately is Elias. But because he's a former world champion, oh, well, you know, he's in the chamber. The last time Jeff Hardy was a world champion in this company, Kanye West interrupted Taylor Swift's speech during the VMAs. The last time Miz held the WWE title was a decade ago. He hasn't touched it since. Neither has Edge, before somebody throws that in my face. But at least he did something. He earned it. He won the Royal Rumble match. So it makes perfect sense that Edge would be able to challenge for a championship. What have these guys won? Nothing. They've done nothing. What has Jeff Hardy done? What has The Miz done? Nothing. Why not base it on what have you done for me lately? Maybe you get one or two newer faces, younger faces, into the chamber. Not a single new face in this chamber match. Why not have qualifying matches on TV? At least they tried to have a few on SmackDown. But there was a great story to be told with Kofi Kingston. Kofi is a former WWE champion. Why isn't he in the chamber? Why not have qualifiers with Kofi Kingston challenging for one of the spots and have Mustafa Ali cost him the match? Just to show him what it feels like to be screwed out of an Elimination Chamber spot just like he was 2 years ago when Kofi replaced him. He's talked about it in his promos. It's not like, oh, well, that was 2 years ago. Nobody talks about that anymore. He's talked about it openly now for weeks. But why not do that? Why not have him show Kofi what it feels like? Now what you've done in doing that, Kofi doesn't get to the chamber. He loses to whoever it is that you want to actually be in the match. But now you've set up a singles match for the pay-per-view next Sunday between Kingston and Ali. That would probably end up being a pretty good match. Now, it probably would end up on the kickoff show, but it would be a pretty good match. Instead, the New Day beat Teabag and Slapdick, and Ali ranted and raved after the match. He was screaming about what losers they are. I don't like Retribution. I think it sucks. It should be disbanded. It should have been disbanded 5 months ago. But if you're going to put them on TV, should you not at least pretend to do something meaningful with them? Charlotte Flair and Lacey Evans. They had a match. They had a rough outing. Who was it on I don't listen to Busted Open, but I hear about these rants sometimes or these segments they or pop up on YouTube. I think it was Bully Ray. Might have been Bully Ray on Busted Open who recent, not too long ago, maybe the last month or two, he went into this whole full-throated defense of Charlotte Flair. He was running down all of the qualities that make her great. One of which was that she has the ability to elevate her opponents. She can have great matches with anybody, even an inferior, inexperienced opponent. She can carry them to a great match. Oh, is that so? Then explain this match. Because this match was no good. And it ended with Charlotte, she was trying to teach her father on the outside a lesson. She was kicking too much ass in the corner, and she shoved the referee, and she got disqualified. And because of this disqualification victory, Lacey Evans will now challenge Asuka for the Raw Women's Championship at Elimination Chamber. Between this and Nia's hole, which I'll dive into in a second, I've got my goggles ready. This division is in shambles right now. It's why I said the Raw Women's Division needs Rhea Ripley. More than SmackDown does. And she's nowhere to be found. She came in second place. She was the runner-up in the Royal Rumble match. I don't think that she's been even mentioned one time on TV since the Rumble. Damian Priest is on TV. I don't know what they're doing with Rhea. Keith Lee at least was back. Thankfully, he's doing well. Keith Lee, not only is he doing, he's doing real well because he proposed to Mia Yim. And so the two of them are going to be tying the knot soon. I saw that proposal photo on Twitter. So Keith Lee's feeling pretty good. He's back on TV. First time in a month. Got a win over Matt Riddle. Bobby Lashley then after destroyed the both of them. And at Elimination Chamber, Lashley is going to defend his United States Championship against both Keith Lee and Matt Riddle. Now, if Lee or Riddle were to pin the other, Lashley could lose the title without being pinned. And that could then open him up to challenge for the WWE title at WrestleMania. Which is just something to think about. He was one of the names when John Cena came out and said, I'm not going to be at Mania, I can't do it. I started floating other names. Sheamus is really the one that makes the most sense. But if you don't want to go with Sheamus, are they going to do that match before? Don't count out Lashley as a possibility as strongly as they have taken great pains to book him over the last several months. his name has to be in the conversation as someone who I think they would consider being in that spot. Lashley has looked totally dominant these last few months. Would be nice if they treated some of their younger talent that way as well, and not just 44-year-old Bobby Lashley. You know, you forget sometimes because Lashley's in great shape. He doesn't really look that old. Shelton Benjamin, same thing. Right? Keeps himself in good shape. He doesn't look old. Lashley's out there. He's 44. Shelton's 45 or 46. MVP is probably closing in on 50. I think Cedric is the only one who's still in his relative youth, who's in the Hurt Business. You got to get some younger guys in there. Or ladies. But then came the tables match. Nia Jax taking on Lana. They replayed the 9 times that Nia Jax put Lana through a table months ago. I thought this story was over and done with. Didn't Lana eliminate her from the Royal Rumble? Like, this was over. You put a bow on it and that was the end of it. And then out of nowhere here, months later, we get a tables match, unannounced, here on TV. Nia was just having her way with this woman until an untimely leg drop on the ring apron. Nia sold this like she sat on a pile of thumbtacks. She screamed, "My hole!" Who remembers that episode of Married with Children when all of the No Ma'am guys went to the strip club and a woman walked out on stage to recite a poem instead about her ovaries? You remember that? My eggs, above my legs. And then Al throws an egg at her. That'll be Nia Jax in 10 years doing poetry readings at her local coffee shop. My hole, that's in her future. I laugh at the people who criticized her for turning this segment into a joke. Like, they were really upset about this. This was one of the best parts of the entire show. It was Nia Jax against fucking Lana. Nobody was taking this seriously from the moment the bell rang. You think anybody in their right mind gave a shit when they announced at this match, you know, after the break or whatever, that they were going to have this, "Oh, I can't wait to see Nia Jax against Lana." No, you're just hoping that something happens that can at least mildly entertain you. And that's what we got. We got her hole. My hole was trending worldwide on Twitter well into Tuesday morning. It's just too bad her hole didn't trend a couple of weeks ago when Jizz Hornkamp was trending. You probably missed that. Imagine waking up from a coma and seeing that. Jizz Hornkamp. It's a real person. Jizz Hornkamp is a Dutch soccer player. Now, up until a few weeks ago, I did not know this. I did not know who Jizz Hornkamp was. I didn't know what Jizz Hornkamp was. I didn't want to know what Jizz Hornkamp was. But Jizz Hornkamp was trending because he scored 4 goals in a single game. Like Al Bundy scored 4 touchdowns in a single game. Jizz Hornkamp scored, and so he trended. I'll bet he did. I'll bet he scored with that name. That's Jizz Hornkamp. It sounds like a fun place to visit in the red light district. But it's too bad they didn't trend simultaneously. I think the world would have exploded. So she won the match, did Lana, when she shoved Bung Holio into a table that was propped up against the barricade. Immediately after this, Naomi rolled up and pinned Shayna Baszler in a separate match, because this is how you build to a championship match, by giving the challengers a pair of fluke wins. That's how you do it. But they closed the show with another match between Drew McIntyre and Randy Orton. After Orton's loss to Edge the week before, which ended with Sheamus going to give... You know what? Let me say this. Because I was sickened when I saw that this was going to be the main event, because these people just don't... They have no fucking creativity at all. I'd like to make a suggestion if I can. If WWE is going to insist on booking the same fucking matches over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. Sometimes it's for the title, sometimes it's non-title, sometimes they'll do a different match, but then the next week it's right back to the old match. This is their MO. They do this every single time. If they insist on doing that and they have no other ideas, I would suggest that they do what I do at the end of every Dynamite stream on Wednesday night. We have our Dynamite family, our Dynamite audience that joins me live on YouTube every Wednesday night. We have a lot of fun. And at the end of every stream, I pitch it over to a tweet that my good buddy Zinfamous HD, shout out to Zinfamous HD for putting this tweet together many, many months ago. You've seen tweets like this where somebody will put together, it's like a GIF that when you click it, it very quickly and randomly goes through a whole bunch of wrestling faces. And then when you click it, it stops on a particular person. So instead of booking the same matches over and over again, I would implore them to go to Zinfamous HD's tweet. Or they could just put together their own. They have their crack production team. I'm sure they could put together their own. And I want them to just completely randomize what these matches are going to be. And just click a button or push a button. And whoever it lands on, that is either Drew's opponent or that is the match, whatever that match may be, for Raw that night. Because to me, that would be a more entertaining way of booking these shows than by giving us the same shit over and over and over again. Because you never know what you're going to end up with. I mean, you could, for God's sakes, I mean, you can end up with Drew McIntyre potentially defending the WWE title if it was going to be a championship match. He could be defending the title against Titus O'Neil. Who else is in the back that we never see eating those great catering sandwiches? They may end up with a main event out of it on Monday Night Raw. Somebody new might actually get over. We can't have that. At least not if they're not handpicked by the company. But I would actually find that to be more entertaining. They could even show it on the big screen. Show everybody. That would be better than just booking these matches over and over again. So Sheamus was out there for the match. He got involved at the very end. Drew looked like he was setting up for a win. He was setting up for the Claymore kick, and Sheamus got in the ring, and he went to go give Drew the brogue kick. And instead, he hit Randy Orton for the disqualification. And McIntyre ended up hitting the Claymore to Sheamus to build not to a singles match, but to the Elimination Chamber, where they will both be part of the Chamber match. And you know what? Without Cena or another big name to face McIntyre, and I'm okay with that. Cena would have been my pick if they insisted on having a big name. I talked about, you know, him going for title number 17. There's a story there they can tell at some point. Now he says he won't be there. But you know that I said what I said out loud before about Lashley possibly losing the U.S. title without being pinned or submitting. He's not going to submit, but either being pinned by Keith Lee or Matt Riddle, but he could still lose, right? If one of them beats the other, he would no longer be the U.S. champion. In the spirit of Edge being back on TV, since he did this once before at an Elimination Chamber, maybe Lashley is so incensed over this loss earlier in the night that he destroys Jeff Hardy, which he's been making a habit out of doing for the last 2 months anyway. He destroys Jeff Hardy before Jeff can take his spot inside one of the pods. Lashley, who has made him submit repeatedly to the Hurt Lock, can do the same thing here. He takes Jeff Hardy effectively out of the match, and he takes his spot in the pod. He basically steals his spot in the Elimination Chamber. And he goes on to win the WWE Championship next Sunday. A shocking twist, even though it's a takeoff of an idea they did many years ago. But a shocking twist, a shocking swerve at the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view next Sunday. Now, I happen to think the way things are set up on the SmackDown side, which I'll talk about here in a second, it's more likely that whatever is going on SmackDown is going to close out the show. So the order of the matches is important as far as how they structure this pay-per-view. Otherwise, there's probably zero chance of this happening anyway. But I almost think you would have to close the show with something like this. But what if that happens and he takes a spot and he goes on to win? So yeah, he lost one title. They got that off him, protecting him somewhat. But then he walks out with the WWE title, the crown jewel of the Hurt Business. For as awful as Raw has been for a while now, I and other people have talked about one of the only redeeming things and good things about Monday Night Raw has been the Hurt Business and the way they've built this faction And they have gotten behind Lashley as this destroyer of sorts, an MVP in that role. When he's not in the ring, I prefer him to not be in the ring anymore because I think his strength is on the mic. But they've really built up this faction, and they've been one of the things to actually watch on Monday Night Raw that doesn't frankly piss me off or make me shake my head. So Bobby Lashley goes all the way, and they make him the champion, and Drew McIntyre now will have his singles match with Sheamus, which they are at some point going to have. Let's say they have their singles match next month at Fastlane. The winner of that match then goes on to WrestleMania to challenge Drew, or to challenge Lashley, I should say, for the WWE Championship. And that's your WWE title match. Drew McIntyre challenging Lashley the Destroyer. There has to be a reason they suddenly got serious about treating Lashley like a monster. And if you are one of these people who believes that the Hurt Business is one of the few redeeming things over the last year about Monday Night Raw, then a Lashley run with the title, even if it's only for a month and a half, should not be so far-fetched. So don't count out that idea as a possibility. Because I'm not sure they have anything else, frankly, that's better than that. It should be Drew and Sheamus. That's the basic story here. But if they don't want to do it, I'm a little worried about what other ideas they may have in mind for Drew McIntyre. Now, tomorrow night, they're doing a gauntlet match with all of the members of the chamber except Drew. He will not be in it. To see who gets to enter the chamber last. AJ Styles, The Miz, Sheamus, Randy Orton, and Jeff Hardy. Maybe Sheamus can go on and on again about Jeff Hardy's drinking problem. It's been a few months. I think we've all forgotten by now. It's about time they remind us again that Jeff Hardy is a drunk, since they love talking about that so much. Now we get to SmackDown. But first, before I do that, let's talk about fairness for a second. You know what's not fair? The fact that Netflix hides thousands of shows from you based on your location, and then has the nerve to increase their prices. That's right. Starting at the end of this month, they're raising prices once again. Now, you could just cancel your subscription in protest, or you could be smart about it and make sure that you're getting your full money's worth by using ExpressVPN like I do. You see, you might not know that what's on Netflix in your country is completely different from what someone in the UK or Japan has on theirs. Using ExpressVPN, I can control which country I want Netflix to think that I'm in. ExpressVPN has over 90 countries to choose from, so every time I run out of stuff to watch, I just switch to another country to unlock new shows. Right now, I'm watching Modern Family. It's not on US Netflix, but with just one tap of a button, ExpressVPN lets me change my location to Singapore and watch the show. And here's the best part. It's not just for Netflix. You can get ExpressVPN to unlock shows on other streaming services too. I've used it to watch BBC iPlayer. It's free and only available in the UK. ExpressVPN is also super fast, and it works on your phone, your laptop, even smart TV, so you can watch your shows on the big screen with zero buffering. So be smart. Stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/solomonster. Don't forget to use my link so you can get 3 extra months free. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. expressvpn.com/solomonster to learn more. I gotta say, that does legitimately piss me off when there is a movie or a TV show I want to watch. And sometimes the old Netflix page for it is still up. They haven't, you know, taken it down yet. But it's not available for streaming. Because, you know, Netflix will cycle stuff in and out. So it is very cool. It is very cool and very convenient to use ExpressVPN. And again, I've been using that for a while. So I think you guys will find some great uses for it. I hope you'll use my link. SmackDown, as I was saying, about to dive into here over on SmackDown. The field has been set for the chamber match, but instead of Roman Reigns defending the Universal title inside the chamber, he'll defend the championship outside the chamber later on in the show against the winner of the SmackDown Elimination Chamber match. Commissioner Pierce said that Kevin Owens and Jey Uso would not have to qualify. They're in automatically because they're the two men who have taken Roman Reigns to the limit in their matches with him in recent months. The other four men would have to qualify, but they would do so in tag team matches, not singles matches. Baron Corbin and Sami Zayn, they took on Rey Mysterio and Dominic Mysterio, who almost killed himself, diving through the ropes out onto Sami. He did a face plant right into the side, into the edge of the announce desk. It reminded me of that just sickening bump that Chris Benoit took on SmackDown many years ago, where he also did this. He was like a rocket. He was coming in for a dive through the ropes, a million miles an hour, and he looked like he broke his back. He didn't go face first into it, but his back, the way his body landed, he's lucky he didn't get a broken back on that bump. But Corbin and Zayn picked up the win, so they're in. You know, I get that they want to have a few heels in there. You don't want it to necessarily be all baby faces. But it's pretty obvious that there's three people in this chamber who are not going to win. Jey Uso is one of them. Baron Corbin is the other. And Sami Zayn, I would say of the three, Sami might have the best shot, but he's got no shot. So the best shot they have is no shot. So we could already wipe out half the number of guys in this match. Apollo Crews still wants another shot at Big E in the Intercontinental title. They had a promo segment in the ring, and at one point Big E lowered the microphone and the two of them stopped doing a promo and they started talking shit to each other like normal people. And without fans in the audience, we can hear everything they're saying. I like that. I like that a lot. It was the most natural verbal exchange that we have had on any of these shows in a very long time, because this is exactly what it would sound like and look like if two people were having an argument. And Big E told him, he goes, I'm done with you. Go back. Go backstage, go to catering. I'm done with you. And Crews said, well, I'm not going anywhere. And Big E asked for them to go ahead and send out his next opponent, which was Shinsuke Nakamura. They had a match that was going pretty well until Crews got involved. He threw a drop kick at Big E for the DQ. We already have a triple threat set for next Sunday for the U.S. title with Lashley, Lee, and Riddle. I think we may get the same here for the Intercontinental title with Big E, Crews, and Nakamura. Nakamura just got screwed out of a championship win. So if anybody deserves another crack at it, it's not Crews, it's Shinsuke Nakamura. So we may get two triple threat matches on the pay-per-view next Sunday. Seth Rollins is back with his old theme music, thank God. But he is still doing the Messiah gimmick. Boring. He said a lot has changed since he sacrificed himself at Survivor Series. Like he threw himself on top of a grenade in Iwo Jima. He sacrificed himself. I mean, please. He said he recently became a parent for the first time. His daughter has changed his life in ways he never could have dreamed of, and it's given him a new vision. You know, most of my friends would say that it gave them blurry vision, because now they get no sleep. It's the one thing I've learned from talking to all of them. Once they have a kid, you can kiss your sleep goodbye. He said that he was surrounded by some of the most amazing talent. He had the most, amazing roster here before him. They were all surrounding the ring. You have like lumberjack matches. This was like a lumberjack promo. He had invited all of them out, so they're all surrounding the ring, except the top stars, because they're not going to be bothered with this shit. So he has all the talent surrounding the ring, and he says after a lot of self-reflection, he realized that he is the great leader that SmackDown needs. And all of the wrestlers walked out on him, all but one, that being Cesaro, who stayed behind. And Rollins was very excited. He looked at him. He goes, ha, you. See, I knew you'd get it. I knew you'd understand. And eventually Cesaro walked out too. He just kind of shook his head and he went to go walk out, which led to Rollins chasing him down in the aisle. He clipped his knee from behind. He started beating him down until Daniel Bryan made the save, because Daniel Bryan was tagging that night in the main event with Cesaro. And so he made the save, and that could be the seed. In fact, I think it is the seed planted for a WrestleMania match with Seth Rollins and Daniel Bryan. Because, as I've said for weeks now, the WrestleMania match is going to be Edge against Roman Reigns, not Daniel Bryan against Roman Reigns. Now, I could also see Cesaro getting a match with Rollins, maybe before WrestleMania, maybe at Fastlane next month. And then at WrestleMania, it's Bryan against Rollins. But you know what? Since Ryan is a big Cesaro fan, maybe he tries to get him in there and they make it a triple threat at Mania. Otherwise, I'm not sure what Cesaro does. Sasha Banks and Bianca Belair. They were chatting in the ring when they were interrupted by the theme music of the Holy One herself, Nia Jax, and Shayna Baszler, who were upset that everybody was talking about Bianca Belair's Royal Rumble victory, and nobody was talking about their win over Charlotte and Asuka in regaining the women's tag team titles. So this led to a brawl, and probably leads to a tag team title match at Elimination Chamber. See, I think they should have played up Sasha Banks walking out. When she came out for this segment, the Street Profits had just wrestled a match and won over Otis and Chad Gable. And as they were leaving and heading to the back, Sasha's music played, she came out, so they passed each other. And for a few seconds there, Sasha Banks was dancing to her theme song with the Street Profits. And one half of the Street Profits happens to be Montez Ford. Montez Ford happens to be Bianca Belair's husband. And so Bianca should have brought that up when she came out and told Sasha to stay away from her man. They haven't acknowledged on television that Ford and Belair are an item, but they mention it all the time on their social media. We're not idiots. That would have been a good spot to bring it up and start to build to Bianca's choice. The choice is obvious. It is the only choice. Her WrestleMania opponent is Sasha Banks. Period. End of story. It should not be anyone else. And these same people telling you that they shouldn't do it, or they should hold off until SummerSlam, it's too soon, you don't do it yet, these are the same people that will bitch and complain for the next 6 months that WWE has no worthy opponents for Sasha Banks. And they'll crow about every person they put her in the ring with. It's called WrestleMania for a reason. I want the best possible matches. This is the match that I want. Daniel Bryan and Cesaro, they qualified for the Chamber match by beating the SmackDown Tag Team Champions in the main event. That should earn them a tag team title match this Friday, since they beat the champions, but trusting them to do what makes sense is always an exercise in futility. But hey, we got another sharpshooter win for Cesaro. I love it. I especially like how he really sits back on the move, too. He makes it look devastating. That's the way it should be done. Jey Uso attacked him after. Corbin and Sami ran out to join in the attack. Kevin Owens ran down. He gave all five other Chamber participants stunners and then looked into the camera at Roman Reigns, who was watching in the back, and he told Roman, "I'm not going away." And in case you had any doubts about the renewed push that started, or it looked like it might be starting a few weeks ago for Shinsuke Nakamura, this sealed the deal. This show here, this sealed the deal. There is no renewed push for Shinsuke Nakamura. He went from heel to babyface, but there is no great big renewed push for Shinsuke Nakamura. Cesaro, what happened is, and I know this was mentioned in The Observer, but Cesaro had not signed his new contract yet. So Nakamura got his spot in that gauntlet match on television all those weeks ago. That was a spot meant for Cesaro. And instead it went to Nakamura. This was before the Royal Rumble. Once Cesaro re-signed, they slotted him back into the spot that they had originally tagged him for. Now on Talking Smack, Cesaro cut this inspiring promo about believing in yourself. It was good. I mean, he was a little choppy there, I thought, but that's kind of the beauty of these Talking Smack promos, is that they're clearly unscripted. They're not memorizing a script. They might have the bullet points. I'm sure they have a sense of what they want to say before they come on set. I don't think anybody is handing them a piece of paper and saying, okay, make sure you read this and do this. And so that's one of the things I actually like about these segments on Talking Smack. And when they have Paul Heyman, for example, who's cutting a promo on Big E, or he's sitting there with Apollo Crews, or in this case, it was Cesaro who came on and grabbed the mic and spent 2 minutes, you know, talking about not giving up and not, you know, ignoring what people are telling you. If they tell you you can't do this, you can't do that. It was meant to be this really inspiring, I think, uplifting promo, but it just comes off way more natural than any promo you would ever see on Raw or SmackDown. So that's what I like about it. That's what I can appreciate about it. I'm enjoying the Cesaro mini push for the few weeks that it's going to last. I know it's only temporary. I'm not falling for it. I'm not stupid. I know it's not going to last. I'm sorry to burst your bubble if you think it's going to, but it's not. That's not me being negative. That's me being realistic about things, okay? So I'm enjoying it temporarily for the time that it's going to last. But it is long past due that this man gets some of the spotlight for himself, not as part of a tag team or a faction or anything like that. I feel like he's been he's had a revolving door of partners, but this guy has been in one giant tag team his entire run, I feel like, on the main roster. And we have Daniel Bryan to thank for it, because Daniel Bryan obviously has some pull on that brand, and he is trying his best to give Cesaro something to do here. I mean, you think about what's so different now all of a sudden that they're giving Cesaro this little push. And, you know, you hear these reports that Daniel Bryan has creative influence or is on the creative team on the SmackDown brand. That's the big difference. There's nothing else that's different. It's still Vince McMahon's show. It's still Vince McMahon's company. You got Vince and Bruce pulling the strings in the back. And, you know, if it were just them, believe me, Cesaro would not be getting this sudden push. So we can thank Daniel Bryan for that. And in fact, look, I think he has a great shot at winning the chamber next Sunday, Cesaro. And then losing to Roman Reigns at the end of the show. Because in the chamber, it's either Owens or Cesaro. And we've now seen Owens face Roman Reigns and lose so many times that my interest level in seeing that again, I like Kevin Owens, but my interest level in seeing them again is almost nil. So I would love to see Cesaro get the shot.
History has been made here.
This week in wrestling history, we go all the way back, half a century, in fact, 50 years ago this week on February 8th, 1971, WWE Hall of Famer Pedro Morales, maybe the biggest Hispanic star that WWE ever had, having sold out Madison Square Garden in title matches 21 times in his career, beat Ivan Koloff to become WWF champion, kicking off a nearly three-year run as the champion, lasting 1,027 days. He's also WWE's first Triple Crown winner, holding the WWE title, the Intercontinental title, on two occasions. That came years later. And the WWE Tag Team titles, once with Bob Backlund before they were forced to forfeit them the following day, because of a rule that stated that the world champion, who was Backlund at that time, could not hold more than one title at one time. Speaking of titles, 46 years ago this week, on that same date in 1975, Ric Flair won his very first singles pro wrestling championship, defeating Paul Jones for the NWA Mid-Atlantic Television title. 37 years ago this week, on February 10th, 1984, the second in a long line of Von Erich family tragedies, David Von Erich died at the age of 25 in his hotel room while on an overseas tour of Japan from what was said to be, and what his brother Kevin insists, was a heart attack that was caused by ruptured intestines resulting from acute enteritis. The story over the years has changed a little bit. I think even with the family, in terms of exactly what went down and when. They've claimed that it was a kick during a match in Japan that ruptured his intestine, which is not true because he died before he even wrestled his first match on that tour. On the Dark Side of the Ring episode devoted to the Von Erich family, which I did a whole review on at that time, Kevin says that David was throwing up before he left for Japan. But his father insisted that he make the trip, and so he flew over there. Ric Flair and a lot of other wrestlers from that period are convinced that it was a drug overdose that killed him. Dave Meltzer, years ago, after Kerry died, noted that David was out at Ribera Steakhouse the night before and was doing a lot of drinking. And the next day, when he didn't come down to the lobby of the hotel, one of the Japanese referees went to the hotel room with Bruiser Brody and found him dead, and that it was, the claim is that it was Brody who flushed the drugs that they found down the toilet, and that it was alleged to be the same drug his brother Michael later overdosed on, which was a drug called Placidil, which is a medication that was commonly prescribed at one time to treat insomnia. I don't even think they manufacture it anymore, in part because so many people were abusing them. We even had a Supreme Court justice in this country who was addicted to them. Kevin says otherwise. And the autopsy backs up his claim, so we'll just have to leave it at that. David was the one that they thought would be the first to win the NWA world title. He never had that chance. Instead, at a tribute show for David a few months later at Texas Stadium, 45,000 people in the stands, it was his brother Kerry, the future Texas Tornado, who would beat Ric Flair to become NWA world champion. Kerry only held the title for 18 days before dropping it to Flair in Japan because Kerry had substance abuse problems of his own and just was not reliable enough to trust in that spot, at least not trust longer than 18 days. And so it was less than 3 weeks later and his run was over. 29 years ago this week, on February 8th, 1992, the first edition of Saturday Night's Main Event to air on Fox after years of airing on NBC. This show is an hour instead of the usual 90 minutes. Taped on January 27th in Lubbock, Texas, with Hulk Hogan and Sid Justice putting aside their differences from the Royal Rumble to take on Ric Flair and The Undertaker. Sid bailed on Hogan mid-match when Hogan reached for the tag. Sid jumped down from the apron. This set up their WrestleMania 8 match. Hogan versus Flair had already been announced on television for the title, but it was never actually planned to be the main event. It was all part of the storyline. We'll announce Hogan versus Flair. Hogan then has this falling out and this issue with Sid, and the match gets changed, and then they can promote a big double main event with Hogan in possibly his final match because he was going away for a while, which honestly, I think as much as anything, that probably has to do with why the Flair match didn't happen. You know, all that stuff about how their house show matches were underperforming and didn't do great business. They ran that match a whole bunch of times. And so it's sort of, you know, granted back then, if it was a live event, people in other markets wouldn't know or they wouldn't see it. It's not like, you know, the internet today. But they did run the match a whole bunch of times. I don't know that they necessarily should have been doing that. But I still think a main event at WrestleMania for the title between Hogan and Flair would have done well. Maybe not as well as it would have done in you know, 1986. But I think as much as anything, Hogan, they knew he was leaving. I don't know when they knew he was leaving, but they knew he was going away for a while with all the scandals that were going on at that time. Hogan, you know, he was going to step away for a while, possibly for a year, which is really what happened. And if that were the case, you would have to have either a disqualification finish so that you don't put the title on Hogan, or Flair would have to beat him. And ha ha ha! Well, we all know that was never going to happen, let alone in the main event of WrestleMania. So that's as much as anything, I think that's why we didn't get the match. Hogan was going away. Otherwise, it would have been an easy Hogan title win, right? It would have been Hulk Hogan winning the championship and posing and celebrating at the end of WrestleMania, which I guess he did anyway. But it was a lot easier for him to get a DQ win over Sid than it would have been in a championship match. And so they got to promote a title match out of it between Hogan, between Savage and Flair. They did the whole big double main event promotion for the show. But this episode also featured the blow-off match to one of my all-time favorite feuds between Macho Man Randy Savage and Jake the Snake Roberts, which should have happened. Talk about matches that should have happened at WrestleMania. This blow-off for this feud deserved a bigger stage. And it deserved to happen at WrestleMania. Savage pinned him clean with the elbow drop. Afterwards, Jake was waiting backstage for Savage and Liz to come back through the curtain. He had a steel chair in his hand. He was gonna do some damage. He had some evil intentions with that chair. And as they came through the curtain, reared back with the chair, but before he can fire away, The Undertaker, who he had been allied with up to that point for several months, The Undertaker grabbed the chair out of his hand and prevented him from using it and turned himself babyface in the process. Now, I think they turned him because a lot of fans were already cheering The Undertaker because they thought he was fucking cool. They loved the gimmick. But this was his official babyface turn. I don't think they actually showed that footage. In fact, I know they didn't. They didn't show that footage until the syndicated shows over the weekend or the following weekend. They even had Vince McMahon and Bobby Heenan who were doing commentary for the show. They really acted as if when they showed this, you know, never before seen footage the following weekend, they were airing this as if, well, okay, we're off the air. Show's over, right? We're off the air. Vince is telling Bobby, he goes, boy, I thought that was your worst performance yet. So they were really milking it, trying to make it as if, okay, this is unplanned now. The show's over. This is not part of the show, folks. And that marked the babyface turn of The Undertaker, who I believe was a babyface all the way up until 1998. 25 years ago this week, on February 11th, 1996, at the WCW Super Brawl pay-per-view, Kevin Sullivan and Brian Pillman were all set to have a strap match where the winner would be determined only when their opponent said the words, "I respect you." Not even a full 60 seconds into the match, Pillman grabbed the mic out of the referee's hand and told Sullivan, "I respect you, Booker man." Before walking out, making reference to Sullivan being the booker at that time for WCW. In late 95, early 96, Pillman was just trying to find a way to stay relevant. You know, WCW had Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage and Ric Flair, all those big names. The Giant, who was new, but he was still, you know, bigger in the pecking order than Pillman was. And he was just looking for a way to break through, and he was very concerned about his future in the company. So he worked with Eric Bischoff to get this new loose cannon gimmick over. And Bischoff claims that he encouraged Pillman to leave WCW and go work elsewhere and then come back to help make himself an even bigger name and really get the gimmick over. I think a lot of that, and that was true of ECW, but I don't buy for a second that Bischoff encouraged him to go get a deal with Vince McMahon. I don't buy that for a second. I think that's more of Bischoff having egg on his face, because he got duped. He got swerved. And he was trying to just save face, because again, Pillman had convinced him to have Turner fax him real release papers to make it look real. Don't just send papers over, send real release papers letting me out of my contract. Which he then used to sign a very real contract with the WWF. But on this night, after Pillman pulled the Booker man line and left, a minute into what was supposed to be a 12-minute match, there was genuine panic backstage, per the Observer. They sent Arn Anderson out to the ring to wrestle Sullivan in an impromptu match. You got to go back and watch this. Arn walks out because Jimmy Hart goes to get him, and here comes Arn Anderson. And Arn Anderson looks like he was dressed for Oktoberfest. In his dress shirt, he's got red shorts on. They went to a no contest when Ric Flair came out and told them to stop fighting because the Dungeon of Doom, which is what Kevin Sullivan was part of, and the Horsemen, which is obviously what Arn was part of, they shared a common enemy, that being Hulk Hogan and Hulkamania. We shouldn't be fighting. We should be uniting. But after this, Pillman was fired, quote-unquote fired, and the idea was that he would get the loose cannon deal over at ECW, because, you know, I'm sure to Bischoff it was no big deal if he went to ECW. ECW was still some, in his mind, it was probably still just a little dumpy promotion. Yeah, they do a lot of risque stuff. Pillman could go there and be very controversial and get himself more over with that audience and fine-tune the character and then eventually come back to Uncle Eric and WCW. Didn't quite work out that way. He had the horrible Humvee wreck. I mean, you talk about just the worst possible thing that could happen at the worst possible time. He had the Humvee wreck. He fell asleep at the wheel. He was in a coma for a week. Didn't know if he would make it. Completely shattered his ankle. Had to have the ankle fused into one position, which really, I mean, it really, for all intents and purposes, it ended his in-ring career. I mean, he was never the same after that. He was in constant pain. How do you wrestle on that? How do you wrestle on an ankle that's fused into one position? And this is a guy, and this is really part of the tragedy of it, is that he was a high-flying performer. You know, they called him Flying Brian for many years for a reason. So he relied on doing stuff where he would go to the top rope and do a big, you know, a big splash or some of these big flashy moves, and that was it. That was done. He was never going to be able to do that ever again. So it didn't just make it harder for him to wrestle. I mean, it didn't make it impossible for him to wrestle pain-free, but he couldn't do all of the things that helped get him over in the first place as Flying Brian. But he was able to negotiate a deal to go to the WWF during this period afterwards when he came out of the coma and he started to recover. And I think he also hid the severity of his injury from WWE. I think if WWE knew how badly he really was hurt, plus the addiction issues that he had, I don't think there's any way they would have signed him. Or if they did, they would have immediately, you know, just tried to get him the help he needed. So I think he hid the severity of it, got the deal with WWE, and like I said, was never the same after that, unfortunately. Pillman was ahead of his time with the loose cannon stuff that he was doing and the promos he was cutting. He was ahead of his time, I would say, probably by a good year or two. He was ahead of his time. A healthy Brian Pillman doing the loose cannon stuff right at the start of the Attitude Era, especially with Steve Austin, right, his former tag team partner, on top as the champion, would have been insanely good. 24 years ago this week, on February 13th, 1997, a special Thursday night episode of Raw, as the Westminster Dog Show aired on Monday night and bumped them to a different slot. And also the night that Shawn Michaels announced to the world that he had lost his smile. He lost his smile. This was supposed to be the rematch from the Royal Rumble, with Michaels defending the WWF title against Psycho Sid in a match that I think Sid may have been scheduled to win. Maybe not originally, but I think as they got closer to the match, because there's so many conflicting stories about what happened and what the plans were and what the plans became, that I think by this point, right before the show, the plan may have been to put the championship on Sid. I know the early plan, and Brett says the same, was that Bret Hart was going to win the Royal Rumble in 1997. And that was the plan. We know that. That was the plan until Vince McMahon changed it to Steve Austin because he felt Vince Russo spoiled the finish. He had Vince Russo was doing his Vic Venom thing on television at the time. So Russo would make appearances on Livewire. And I'm still waiting on those Livewire episodes, by the way, to drop on the network. I don't have a lot of faith that once they move to Peacock, they're going to be in any kind of rush to get all the old stuff up, but I hope they do at some point, and they don't edit too much out of it, because those shows, to go back and watch them now, the ones you can find on YouTube, you know, you talk about things that were ahead of its time. I mean, they were taking a risk by going live and taking phone calls on TV like that, but they would have Russo in studio for Livewire. He was doing the stuff with the magazine at the time. And I think he was asked on one of the episodes, who do you think is going to win the Royal Rumble? What's your prediction? And he said, well, Bret Hart is going to win the Royal Rumble. Well, Bret Hart was going to win the Royal Rumble, and Vince McMahon was pissed because he thought Russo had basically spoiled the finish. And Russo said, look, he told McMahon, he goes, nobody told me, you know, Bret's going to win. You just asked me for my opinion. That's honestly who I believe was going to win, because he thought it was so predictable. He thought it was so obvious that Bret was going to win the Rumble. So McMahon changed it to swerve everybody. Didn't plan on sending Steve Austin to the WrestleMania main event, as you can tell. But because it was in his mind, oh, you said who the winner is going to be, we have to change it. So we know that. We know that Bret was going to originally win the Rumble that year. He was going to win the Rumble and then get his win back over Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 13. But by this point, the decision may have already been made to go with Undertaker challenging Sid in the WrestleMania main event for the championship, with Bret against Shawn underneath. So it wouldn't be for the title, but we would still get the Bret versus Shawn rematch from WrestleMania 12. Michaels, though, threw a wrench into everything when he announced that he was going to have, you know, knee surgery. His knee was so bad that his doctors told him he may never wrestle again. That's how horrible this knee injury was that he had. And he may have had a knee injury. You know, when you fly around the ring the way that Shawn Michaels used to, you're probably going to have knee problems. So I don't doubt that there may have been some kind of a knee injury. Did he exaggerate the seriousness of that knee injury? Do I believe he exaggerates? Absolutely. 100%. But he's out there, you know, talking and tears in his eyes. And he's talking about this like, oh, my career may be over. And he had to forfeit the championship. So the title was vacated. And there was a legitimate belief that he may never be able to wrestle again. That's why they had him come out and do the speech instead of doing an angle where, you know, Austin or Sid or somebody attacked him because they didn't want to touch him physically. They thought, oh boy, his knee is so bad. You know, we don't want to do anything to make it worse. As it turned out, he was back in the ring less than 3 months later, looking like he never missed a day. In fact, he was back at WrestleMania doing commentary and dancing. He had an entrance. He was dancing in the ring. He didn't look like somebody who had just been told he would need reconstructive surgery that was going to keep him out and possibly end his career. So it was a miraculous recovery for Shawn Michaels. So the final four match at the next pay-per-view all of a sudden became a championship match. Now, also on this night, Rocky Maivia won his first title in WWE. He beat Triple H to become Intercontinental Champion, making him, at the age of 26, the youngest champion, Intercontinental that is, in the history of the company, until Randy Orton came along in 2003 at the age of 23, and he became the youngest Intercontinental Champion of all time 6 years later. But even on this night, with Rock winning the championship and everything, he was already getting a lot of blowback from the crowd, too much too soon. There were people in the audience chanting, Rocky sucks. So the backlash had already begun. 23 years ago this week, on February 9th, 1998, the date of the infamous encounter on WCW Monday Nitro between Bill Goldberg and Lord Steven Regal. He had just returned, Regal did, from a suspension after an incident on a flight from Tokyo to Detroit, where he urinated on a flight attendant. I mean, who among us hasn't done that? He was wasted in the restroom, and the door was not completely shut. And when the lady tapped him on the shoulder, and by the way, why is she tapping him on the shoulder if he's in the middle of urinating in the bathroom, is what I would like to know. But again, he was wasted, so maybe he was making a scene, or again, if the door was open, she may have just wanted to, maybe she thought he was washing his hands or something, I don't know. But she tapped him on the shoulder, and when she did, he spun around in the middle of peeing, and he peed on her. And the next thing he remembers, he woke up in a jail cell in Alaska in an orange jumpsuit cuffed to another inmate. This guy that he doesn't know and he's never met before. So he told Steve Austin on his podcast in 2014 that he was on his best behavior here because that incident had just happened. He was just back. And the agent in charge, and he never named who the agent was, but the agent in charge of the match wanted him to go 6 minutes with Goldberg, which is more than twice as long as any of Goldberg's previous matches up to that point in his career, because he only debuted on TV in September. And all of his matches were quick squashes that were over in 2 minutes or less. So him going out there and having a competitive match for 6 minutes was different. It was different for what Goldberg was used to. Go 6 minutes and have a competitive match. That is what Regal says the instructions to him were. And that's what he did. It was the most competitive match of Goldberg's career up to that point. They go out there and Regal says that Goldberg froze up early in the... So in the first like couple of minutes of the match, there's a point, if you watch it back, where it looks like Goldberg gets lost or he freezes up. He doesn't know what to do. And he's trying to get him to do stuff, but he's lost and he just... Again, he's inexperienced. He went from Goldberg to Greenberg. He didn't know what to do. Goldberg has commented on this. He says that Regal took liberties with him and made him look foolish on purpose. I watched the match back again. I'd seen it years ago. I watched the match back again before recording this because I wanted to have it fresh in my mind and see it for myself before I commented on it. And honestly, it's not a bad match. I know people love to say, oh, it was a disaster. I mean, for his career, maybe it was, for Regal's career. The match itself, it's not perfect. It's not pretty. It's not a pretty match. But it's really not a bad match. It's really not. And I don't know if it's just that I've seen some really bad wrestling in the last 10 years or what? You can clearly tell when Goldberg gets lost, but it just comes off like a stiff wrestling match. Goldberg gets some cool-looking takedowns. Regal is, you know, he's the no-nonsense Brit. He's in there working stiff. There's a couple of botch spots that do make you cringe a little bit. But I don't think the match is as bad as people make it out to be. It was kind of nice, actually, to see Goldberg get tested for the first time. He still hit the spear. He still won with the jackhammer. But I don't think anybody watching in the building that night came away thinking, oh, this guy's been exposed. Oh, Goldberg, that's it. The push is over. You know, this guy sucks. So, again, I didn't see any of that. But Regal says he got to the back. Eric Bischoff came up to him, livid, screaming at him. And Regal tells him, look, I can't hit myself. Or meself. I like the way he says it. When he talked to Austin and the way he describes it, I like the way he says it. He says to Eric, I can't hit myself. I can't hit myself. You know, the other person has to be able to work with me. The belief has always been that he was fired immediately after this match. Regal says he was there for 5 more months, in fact, and the reason he was fired was because he was just messed up on drugs. Now, I don't doubt that that was either it or that was part of it. He was not there. He was definitely not there 5 more months. His timeline is screwed up when he says that. He was actually fired the very next month. And I'm sure the drugs did have a lot to do with that. But, you know, you got to think that this match here didn't help. The first week of May, he flew out to Connecticut to meet with Vince McMahon for the first time and Jim Ross and the rest of their team. So this was like a big job interview for him, right? I don't think he had been signed yet. Or maybe he did. Maybe he signed and this was just him going up there for the initial meeting with everybody. I don't know that, but he flies up there. He had gotten his hands before the meeting. He had gotten his hands from someone somewhere on some pills because he had a problem. He needed his pills. And during that meeting, he passed out at Vince McMahon's desk. Which is not the best first impression to make, either on your job interview or if you've already been hired, your first day meeting the boss. You don't want to pass out on his desk. It's probably not going to leave a very good first impression. But nobody knew that he had a drug problem yet. They just thought he was sick. Maybe he's under the weather. He's got some kind of virus. In June, he debuted on Raw. I think just as Steven Regal. He was not doing the man's man thing yet. He debuted on Raw. He had one match against Darren Drozdov, and he looked bad enough that we didn't see him for months until he did finally come back later in the fall with the man's man gimmick. In his book, Regal himself says that, you know, when he's talking about his Raw debut, he says, I looked like a bag of shit. It was not a good time in the life of Steven Regal. 22 years ago, on February 14th, 1999, it was the St. Valentine's Day Massacre with the first ever singles match between Vince McMahon and Stone Cold Steve Austin, not counting that non-match they had on Raw in April of 98. I don't count that as a match. It never happened. It was a no contest. That was Dude Love coming out and ruining it, so I don't count that. This was their first official one-on-one meeting against each other. Through this whole Austin versus McMahon feud. It was also the final pay-per-view to use the In Your House subtitle. A show that saw Al Snow and Hardcore Holly fight out of the arena and into the mighty Mississippi River. And Austin defeat McMahon when McMahon's master plan backfired. So, some backstory first. Vince McMahon had won the Royal Rumble match, right? To earn a championship shot at WrestleMania. He was going to forego his shot and allow The Rock to pick his own opponent. Instead, we were told by Shawn Michaels, who was the commissioner at that time, that per the WWE rulebook, which I've never seen a picture of, I would love to get myself a copy of this rulebook, if the winner of the Royal Rumble cannot or will not compete for the championship at WrestleMania, the runner-up would get their spot instead, that being Stone Cold Steve Austin. Austin then agreed to put his WrestleMania title match on the line if McMahon agreed to meet him in a cage match, and so that is how we got to this point. McMahon took this hellacious bump off the side of the cage down through the announce table. He had to be probably 10 feet up or so at 53 years old, taking a bump like that. Absolute madman. Austin had the match won later on when Paul White made his debut coming off his run as the Giant in WCW. He really was the first big name from WCW to come over to WWE. I know, you know, Jeff Jarrett did, Sean Waltman had come over the year prior, but the Giant was a bigger star than either of those guys. So he came up through the ring, he slammed Austin into each side of the cage, and then he picked him up like a small child, and he hurled him into one of the side panels on the cage, which came loose, and as it slowly swung open with Austin on it, this was the old blue bar cage, except it was black. I do miss those cages. I guess the wrestlers don't because it hurt like a bitch when you would get thrown into it. But that was the last appearance that we ever had of the blue or black bar cage. Austin just slowly begins to climb down. And his feet touch the floor, and he wins the match. Now, I thought at that time, and I still think all these years later, over 20 years now, that was a pretty clever finish. The whole, you know, throw him into the cage, and then he climbs down as the thing swings open. I liked that. I thought that was a clever finish to the match. And with the win, Austin punched his ticket to WrestleMania to challenge The Rock for the championship. A match that some people in the company tried to get changed. There's a lot of stories about that WrestleMania 15 main event. Vince Russo, for example, and this is his story, claims that he had pitched Mankind to be added to the match to make it a triple threat, sort of a reward of sorts for all that Foley had put himself through and done for the company over the year prior. And he said that Vince McMahon was receptive to the idea, and at one point it was thought that this would be a triple threat. It would be Austin, Rock, and Mankind, who had been feuding with Rock for many months for the title, right? Playing hot potato with the belt up until that point. Let's get Mick in there. Let's get Mick a WrestleMania main event. He's not going to win, but let's get him in there. But he says that Shawn Michaels, for whatever reason, he doesn't know why, Shawn Michaels, who was around sometimes at that point, behind the scenes, was in Austin's ear. And he suspects that he was trying to convince him that, no, this needs to be a one-on-one match. It shouldn't be a three-way. Foley shouldn't be in the match. Or maybe Rock. Whoever it was that Michaels thought should be out of the match, he thought it should be one-on-one. Austin eventually went to Vince McMahon and said, look, I don't feel really comfortable about this being a triple threat. It should be one-on-one. Let's do me and Rock. And so even though he had signed off on the other idea for a triple threat, McMahon changed it to, which is a better match. I mean, it should never have been a triple threat. Vince McMahon changed it to one-on-one. Austin against The Rock. Now, Foley was part of it. He didn't technically get to be involved in his first WrestleMania main event because he came out to be the referee and count the winning fall. So that was maybe the consolation there. That's how we'll get Mick to at least be part of this match in some way. And then he presented Austin with the belt when the match was over. So I do believe him. I do believe there is truth to that story. And Foley may have talked about it in his first book, Have a Nice Day. I have the book. I haven't gone back and checked. He may have mentioned that same story. That originally he was going to be part of that match as a wrestler. I just don't remember what he may have said about it. The Rock himself did some kind of Facebook Live thing, I think, a while back, maybe a few years ago, and he actually was answering questions and talked about the fact that he didn't name names, but he talked about the fact that there were people in the locker room who actively lobbied for him to be removed from that WrestleMania main event and not be in the match. He's too young, he's too green, he doesn't belong in there. Now, I have always heard that the people who were talking the loudest, trying to get Rock 86th from that match, was Shawn Michaels and or Triple H. They didn't want Rock in there. They lobbied for him to be removed and either do Austin against Triple H or even Austin against Mankind. And Vince McMahon wouldn't budge. But, so who knows? Who knows who the names were that Rock is referring to? It would make sense that it would be Triple H or Michaels and Triple H. The jealousy was real. Back then, I believe it. I believe the jealousy was very real. 11 years ago this week, on February 11th, 2010, it was on this date during a WWE investors call that Vince McMahon unexpectedly announced the death of Survivor Series, which the previous year had dropped from 191,000 pay-per-view buys in North America the year before to 136,000 pay-per-view buys. We think that Survivor Series is obsolete as far as that title is concerned. It was something that worked many, many years ago in terms of a creative standpoint, various teams competing. Survivor Series many years ago was one of the original four pay-per-views, but it has outlasted its usage, and it is one of the things in terms of rebranding this year and going forward that will be rebranded. No longer will we have that title. You've heard the expression used before when it comes to WWE, plans change. Well, plans changed. And by June, Vince McMahon had reversed his decision after WrestleMania 26 that year saw a similar drop in pay-per-view buys. And with both of those shows, Survivor Series the previous year and WrestleMania that year, coming the day after a UFC pay-per-view, they realized that maybe the name isn't really the problem after all. And Survivor Series got a reprieve, and it has continued to live on as it has since 1987. A decade ago, you believe it, a decade ago, this week on Valentine's Day 2011, The Rock returned to WWE after a 7-year absence, appearing on Monday Night Raw as the surprise host of that year's WrestleMania, which served as the kickoff to a 3-year program with John Cena, which led to back-to-back WrestleMania main events each of the next 2 years. 9 years ago this week, on February 12th, 2012, at TNA's Against All Odds pay-per-view, the opening match between Jesse Sorensen and Zema Ion, now Joaquin Wilde of Legado del Fantasma on NXT, to crown a number one contender for the X Division Championship, ended with an unplanned countout win for Ion after he landed straight down on top of Sorensen's head outside the ring on a moonsault. More specifically, his knee connected with Sorensen's skull. Sorensen instantly collapsed to the ground. Referee Brian Hebner rushed over to check on him and told him, you know, got to get back in the ring. And when he didn't, he told him, if you don't get back in the ring, I'm going to count you out. And Sorensen, who was still conscious at least, had to tell Hebner, I can't move, I'm paralyzed. He had no feeling from the waist. I think he had very minimal feeling from the waist up, but he had no feeling from, I don't know if it was the chest down or the waist down, because he was having issues even with his hands and stuff. So he was pretty much paralyzed. Most of his body was paralyzed. He suffered a C1 vertebrae fracture with spinal cord edema, which is an injury that should have killed him and would have killed most people. He was in the very, very, very small percentile of people who actually survived the injury, or at least survived and did not suffer even more damage, and eventually actually got back in the ring and is leading, by all accounts, a normal life and walking again. He's a miracle in that respect. He was very, very, as unlucky as he was very, very lucky. And it reminds me of the Tyson Kidd injury, where he was in the 5%, I think they said, of people who actually survive a spinal cord injury like the one that he suffered. It was a matter of inches that saved his life in the case of Sorensen. Sorensen did promos later on about how he hoped that Zema Ion would go on to win the X Division title because he would be ready and happy to challenge him for the championship. But he never did. He never did return. TNA gave him a job instead as a production assistant. And despite promises, he claims, from Dixie Carter to he and his mother that, quote, as long as I have this company, you'll always have a job. They did eventually release him. He did an interview years ago with High Spots and said that his mother was at the hospital after it happened. She was freaking out about, everything. Obviously, she just saw her son. She watched it happen on pay-per-view. And they were, you know, figuring, okay, he's just selling an injury or whatever. And then to find out, no, your son is being rushed to the hospital. And I don't know what they told her or what they didn't tell her. But then to find out your son is seriously injured. He's paralyzed. He may never walk again. He may not survive. They told him he may not survive the night. That's how touch and go it was that first 24 to 36 hours. So his mother was freaking out anyway. But his mother, he says, was really freaking out as well about the bills and the cost of all of this and the medical bills. You know, he was only 22 years old at the time. He was still on his mother's medical insurance. And the medical insurance was shit. And it maxed out, I think. It was capped, I think, maybe at $10,000 worth of coverage. His treatment cost a lot more than $10,000. Look, my knee surgery, okay, a few years ago, which wasn't anywhere close to as serious or as involved as his injury here, that cost $28,000. And this kid and, you know, his mom had to pay for their own MRIs and CAT scans and rehab and everything. The only way his mother was able to get rid of all the bills that were piling up, he said, was to file for personal bankruptcy. Now, back in the day, Dixie Carter would do these Ask Dixie hashtags. Remember Ask Dixie? We're going old school now. Old days of the sound off here. Dixie would do Ask Dixie on Twitter and take questions from fans. And after they fired Sorensen, she did one of these Ask Dixie deals. I don't have any fucking idea why she thought that would be a good idea, because they got a lot of backlash when they let him go. So she was doing Ask Dixie and she was getting raked over the coals, as you would expect. Again, how stupid can you be to expect that people are going to ask you about anything other than this guy that got injured on your watch that supposedly you promised a job for life to and then you fired him? So she was getting a lot of heat. And what happened is, according to Sorensen, Dixie called him. This is after they fired him now. She called him and allegedly asked if they could release a joint statement together, saying that the release was 100% amicable and that he asked for it. He asked to be let go so that he could go ahead and pursue other interests, which was not true. And he flat out told her no, and good for him standing up for himself. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. Of course I'm not going to do that. He said his mother was furious at Dixie for even asking such a thing. But I do love the story he also tells, because Kurt Angle visited him in the hospital. We know that. Kurt admitted he went, Kurt was in TNA at the time, and he went and visited him and told everybody, oh, you know, he's doing okay, he's going to be fine, blah, blah, blah. So, as Sorensen tells it, when Kurt came to visit him, and this is during a time where he was laid up in the hospital feeling sorry for himself, he was in a lot of pain, wasn't really getting up out of bed. Who should come bursting into his room but Kurt Angle, unannounced? Angle shows up and he starts yelling at him and telling him to get up, stop feeling sorry for yourself, get on with your life. I just picture, you know, Kurt Angle bursting through the wall like the Kool-Aid Man. But you know what? After that, Sorensen says he managed to walk down the hallway to make it to the bathroom on his own power. Forget Cameo. Kurt Angle can make a killing by offering to randomly burst into people's hospital rooms and motivate them to get their ass out of bed. Just 2 days later, Dixie Carter posted the following announcement on her Facebook page. TNA and Vince Russo have mutually parted ways. As of this week, the separation is amicable and professional. We are glad for the opportunity to have worked together and wish each other nothing but good luck and success in the future. The separation would not be permanent, though. In July of 2014, so only 2 years later, Russo was outed as a creative consultant working for the company after he accidentally emailed notes for TNA announcers Mike Tenay and Taz to Mike Johnson of PW Insider instead. He got his mics mixed up. The belief is that his working with TNA was being kept secret, at least in part, because they didn't want Spike TV to find out. Now, Russo himself and others may have disputed that there was any kind of animus on the part of the network towards him, and they didn't even know who he was, or whatever his rebuttal is for that. But that was the belief, that at least in part, they felt they had to keep this a secret, because if the network found out that Russo was back, they would not be happy about things at all. So they kept this very hush-hush. It was like a big clandestine thing, and nobody was supposed to know that Vince Russo was consulting until he sent that fucking email to Mike Johnson, who had already been suspecting that he might be back with the company, and he wasn't getting any answers, but then he got his answer, all right. When he was accidentally either sent or CC'd or whatever on that email, he got his answer real quick about whether or not Vince Russo was back working for TNA. Just what a fucking mess this whole thing was. And by the way, on the whole Spike thing, so they find out now, right? Because now it's out in the open. And a week later, I think it was only 1 week later, is when Spike canceled Impact. What a fucking mess. Now, after Mike Johnson outed Russo, what was his response? Instead of just admitting that he made a mistake and sent an email to the wrong Mike, he instead dug his heels in and insisted that he did it on purpose to swerve him. That was his initial excuse. Bro, I did that on purpose, bro. I was trying to swerve you, bro. I knew what I was doing, bro. He was just trying to swerve Mike Johnson. And of course, to his credit, Mike Johnson knew that was bullshit. He called him out on his bullshit. He said it was not a swerve. And he threatened to publish the email for everybody to see for themselves so that people would see that it was legit. A few hours later, Russo issues a statement on his website, striking a much more contrite tone, admitting that he sent the email accidentally and he was, you know, coming clean, that he had been, in fact, secretly working for TNA. Would have saved himself a lot of trouble if he would have just been honest from the beginning. 6 years ago, on February 8th, 2015, Lucha Underground taped an episode for its first season from the Temple in Boyle Heights. Episode 24, for anybody who wants to go back, it aired on April 22nd. Because they would tape these months in advance before they would finally air on TV. And I think they had everybody who was in attendance at the taping sign confidentiality agreements so spoilers didn't leak. It was an episode titled Trios Champions that saw the crowning of the first ever Lucha Underground Trios Champions, with Son of Havoc and Helico and Ivelisse defeating Big Rick, Killshot, and the Mac. Before Dario Cueto then came out and informed them that in fact they have not yet won, they have to beat one final team in order to become champions, and that was the Crew, which was the team of Cortez Castro, Mr. Cisco, and Bale. The same Bale who later on in the series had his face eaten off by Matanza, Dario Cueto's monster brother. I'm telling you, man, if you never got into Lucha Underground, you really missed out. You gotta go back. You can watch all the seasons, all the episodes. They're on, I think, a few different services. They're probably on, you'll probably get them off Apple, but I think they're on Tubi TV, and they're in a few different places. I encourage you, especially those first couple of seasons, to give it a shot. But this was the match. This final match before they crowned new Trios champions. This was the match that featured one of the most insane spots, insane dives that I've ever seen, which had Angelico jumping off of the balcony that they had inside the temple. So there was like, you got to picture this place. It was a very intimate establishment. I love the look and the feel of the temple. It was basically like an abandoned warehouse that they turned into this little arena. And, you know, there was a point at the top. It wasn't that high. I mean, it was high enough, but you can't picture, you know, Madison Square Garden or anything like that. But at the top, there was just an area where there was like a little platform. I don't even remember how he got up there, but Angelico was laying up there. He'd been taken out. And down below, his partners were in real trouble. And it's like, he's never going to make it back down in time to rescue his opponents. But Angelico had a reputation for doing crazy dives and crazy shit. And so what he did was he built up a head of steam and he took off and he flew through the air. He flew gracefully through the air all the way down onto the heels and wiped them out down below. A spot so crazy that Vampiro leaped up out of his seat and threw down his headset and he started running back and forth. He didn't know what to do with himself. And Son of Havoc, Angelico, and Ivelisse would become the first ever Lucha Underground Trios Champions. I really do miss that show. Just talking about it just now really hit me. I really do miss Lucha Underground. I wish they would have at least had the chance to wrap things up in the correct, wrap up all the stories and everything the correct way. And they never did. It's just going to forever be this loose thread just hanging there that never got the resolution it deserved. 5 years ago this week, on February 8th, 2016, Daniel Bryan took to Twitter to announce his retirement from the ring, saying, "Due to medical reasons effective immediately, I am announcing my retirement. Tonight on Raw, I will have a chance to elaborate." Bryan was out for much of 2014 after winning the WWE title at WrestleMania. He had a neck issue. He came back in December, and he entered himself into the Royal Rumble match, which, as I have said before, hindsight now looking back at what they did and what happened, that was a huge misfire on their part. That was a huge mistake. If he was not going to win the Royal Rumble, he wasn't even in the Royal Rumble in 2014, but he was in the match in 2015 when he came back. And if he wasn't going to win, because people still had this hunger to see Daniel Bryan win the Royal Rumble and have this great comeback story from injury and go to WrestleMania, and if that wasn't the plan, and they were trying so hard at that time at the beginning of 2015 to get Roman Reigns over as the next big babyface, but people still were into Bryan, putting him in that match was the worst thing they could have done. It really was the worst thing they could have done, because what it also did was, it didn't just piss off the fans, what it did was it completely fucked over Roman Reigns through no fault of his own. He did nothing wrong, but the company screwed him over. But Bryan went on to win the Intercontinental title at WrestleMania 31. A month later, he had to forfeit the championship due to concussion issues. And he had not wrestled the match since. So now we're in 2016, and now comes the retirement announcement. He's already been out of the ring for almost a year, and now it's been made official. He will not be cleared, and he will not be allowed back, at least not in WWE, he will not be allowed back in the ring. And he was doing everything in his power to get cleared by WWE to come back. He saw so many doctors. He got cleared by them. He got cleared by a doctor at UCLA. He got cleared by the neurologist for the Arizona Cardinals of the NFL. He was doing hyperbaric chamber treatment to help his brain, which had been proven to be effective, I think, in some case. He was trying everything he could, and he got clearances from certain doctors, but he didn't get clearance from the one doctor that he needed clearance from, which was the WWE doctor. He refused to clear him, and his opinion was the only one that mattered. So Vince McMahon, when he got the news from the doctor, he called up Bryan himself, and he gave him the bad news. And he said, look, Raw's going to be in Washington State. Bryan's from Aberdeen. They were going to be in Seattle for Raw that Monday night. I want you to come to Washington. I want you to come to Raw, and I want to give you a microphone and let you go out there, and you can have a segment to say whatever it is that you want to say. You go out there, you make the announcement, you address the crowd. And that's what he did. And Bryan admitted that within his first 5 months of training to become a pro wrestler, he had suffered 3 concussions. So imagine how many more concussions he must have suffered over the course of the next, whatever it was, 15, 16 years of his career. And recent tests had shown, there was one test that came back that showed some kind of lesion on his brain. So the speech he gave is up there with the Edge retirement speech on Raw as two of the most difficult segments to watch in Raw history. I mean, most Raw segments these days are difficult to watch. But on a serious note, these were difficult in a whole different kind of way. And now, 5 years later, Bryan and Edge are back in the ring. Funny enough, it was only when Bryan was nearing the end of his contract and he was openly in interviews, openly talking about wanting to go and wrestle in other places. I know he still wants to go to Mexico and have, I think, a hair match. What was it, with Blue Demon or I forgot exactly who it was. But he was talking openly about doing all of these things. And yeah, I'm not going to stop wrestling. You know, he had been away from it for so long, but he still wanted to do it. So he was talking very openly about that and coming to the end of his contract. And all of a sudden, WWE became receptive to the possibility of him wrestling again. Same with Edge. Edge got an offer from Tony Khan to come work for AEW. He was going to be an agent or a coach or something, but also have a few matches. It might be similar to the deal that Sting got, right? Where Sting comes in, Sting's not going to be wrestling all the time, but he'll have a few special matches throughout the year. That was the offer he got from AEW, and I'm sure it was a good money offer too. But out of loyalty and respect to Vince McMahon, he felt he had to go to Vince and just tell him, look, I got this offer. I just want you to know, I got this offer and I'm considering it, or I'm going to consider it, unless you have, you know, something that you might want to offer me. And all of a sudden, he got, you know, after telling Vince McMahon this, Vince McMahon tells him, hey, let's talk. And after 9 years away, Edge is back in the ring when he was told, we're never going to clear you again because you have spinal stenosis and it's just too risky to let you back in the ring. Only when Edge said, hey, I have an offer to go wrestle somewhere else. Hey, let's talk. Hey, there might be a way. There might be a way to get you back in the ring in a safe way. Realistically, there is no safe way. If you're going to wrestle, unless it's like a one-off and every precaution in the world, you don't take any bumps and stuff, like, realistically, there is no way. Edge is back, and he's taking bumps. He spent an hour in the Royal Rumble a few weeks ago. He's getting slammed. Edge is back. He's wrestling the same way he wrestled 9-10 years ago. There is no safe way to wrestle, realistically. You're still at risk every time you get in the ring, but obviously something changed. And now Edge is back in the ring. It's interesting how that works, is all I'm saying. Very interesting how that works. Bryan and Edge also happen to be working for the creative teams now for Raw and SmackDown, respectively. So they're pretty well embedded in the company right now. It was a very nice segment, though. It ended in a very different way. It ended with Titus O'Neil in the final shot of the live broadcast, grabbing Vince McMahon's arm as they were, because the roster had gathered on stage to applaud Bryan and give him a standing ovation. So they were all standing. As Bryan came to the back, he passed everybody. And as the McMahons were then going to return to the back, Titus, in a very playful way, grabbed Vince McMahon's arm. And he wasn't trying to be malicious or anything like that, but it was enough to earn him a 60-day suspension, which at first was going to be 90 days, or I think they may have actually announced it as 90 days, and it got knocked down to 60 because there was so much backlash to it. But Vince McMahon considered firing him first. So he went from, we're going to fire this guy, to we're going to suspend him for 90 days, and eventually it became a 60-day suspension instead. And look, I get it. You need to read the room, as they say, in certain situations, and that was not really the time nor the place. Emotions were running high. One of the top stars in the company, who everybody loved, just made the most difficult announcement of his life and announced that he was prematurely being forced into an early retirement. And I'm sure, look, it was tough for Vince McMahon too. I'm sure he probably had tears in his eyes, and he was also emotional for Bryan. And we've heard plenty of stories of Vince McMahon grabbing other guys, trying to, you know, single leg them and take them down on airplanes and stuff and being obnoxious. But this was not the time nor the place for that. So I understand why he would have been upset. You know, I get that. I'm sure Vince McMahon was not in the mood to be playful, but it was still excessive. Firing the guy would have been fucking ridiculous, but even the 60-day suspension was excessive. Batista was furious. Batista and Titus are best friends. I mean, Batista and Titus are thick as thieves. Batista was absolutely just fuming over this whole situation. And he told Titus, I think he might have even tweeted it out, he told him, you got to ask for your release. He wanted him to ask for his release. That's how upset he was at how his friend was being treated. And finally, this one's a little bit out of order, but I thought we would end with this because, you know, tonight being NXT TakeOver Vengeance Day and all, it was 6 years ago this week, on February 11th, 2015, at NXT TakeOver Rival, only the fourth TakeOver they ever did, that we had two major title changes. Sasha Banks won her first and only NXT Women's Championship, defeating Charlotte Flair, Bayley, and Becky Lynch in an excellent Fatal 4-Way match. And Kevin Owens, just 2 months after making his NXT debut, and 2 months after Sami Zayn beat Adrian Neville to become NXT champion. And Owens turned on Sami his first night, his very first night in the company on that show. Here, Owens beat Zayn by ref stoppage to become the NXT champion. He was repeatedly powerbombing him. He powerbombed him 4 times. He was going for a 5th. And the trainers and doctors were outside. The referee didn't know what to do. And finally, the referee just kind of dove in the way that like a UFC referee would dive in when he's ready to call for a stoppage. And the fans were booing the finish and they didn't know what to make of it. I don't think they realized that they had just witnessed a title change until the referee grabbed the belt and physically went to hand it to Kevin Owens. And then they got this big pop. But people couldn't believe what they had seen. And Kevin Owens was the new NXT champion. And would go on to debut on the main roster. I guess it was only a few months later. Started feuding with John Cena. He was still NXT champion at that time. And that is this week in wrestling history. Follow me on Twitter at Salamonster. And join me live on YouTube tonight immediately following NXT TakeOver Vengeance Day. We'll talk about the good, the bad. I was going to say the good, the bad, and the ugly. But usually don't get any ugly on these TakeOver shows. So my expectations are usually pretty high. Hopefully tonight is no different. But join me there. That'll be podcast number 2 for the day. And we'll get back to your email questions next week. I curated a whole bunch of them. I just don't have time now to get to them. But we'll keep building that up. And we'll get to your questions hopefully next week again. And maybe even tonight, frankly, on the stream. Right? When we're done. If you have questions or super chats or whatever you want to send them on in, I'm open to whatever those questions may be. Please do not forget two very important announcements here in terms of our sponsors and those who support this podcast. We have that great new deal with Amazon Music. You will get 30 days free, absolutely 100% free of Amazon Music Unlimited when you use our link. You can cancel at any time. GetAmazonMusic.com/Salamonster. There's a lot of cool stuff on there in terms of the music they offer and the playlists and, of course, the podcasts. GetAmazonMusic.com/Salamonster. And, of course, ExpressVPN, which is working with us here in 2021. Very happy and excited about that. The only way that continues is if you actually use our link, ExpressVPN.com/Salamonster. Because if you don't, then that's not good for the podcast. But it's great for you because it's a great offer. You get 3 months free. ExpressVPN.com/Salamonster. Check it out. You get a lot of good uses out of a VPN. Not just for watching content either on streaming services that maybe you don't have access to in your country. Just for safety and privacy and protection. It's just smart to be using a VPN. And they're one of the more trusted VPN services that I've used myself. I would not be advertising it if I hadn't used it myself. You get the Salamonster seal of approval. ExpressVPN.com/Salamonster. And I will be back with episode 692 next Sunday. Of course, the usual Dynamite stream on Wednesday. Probably doing Elimination Chamber predictions on YouTube at some point. I don't know if it'll be Thursday night. It might be. It just depends on, you know, what information I have available to me about the card. If they announce more matches between now and then, we'll see. But I hope you guys have a great week. This is President's Day week. I know some of you are probably off from work. So enjoy the holiday if you are. Be well. Stay safe. Come on over to YouTube tonight to join me for podcast number 2. And then 692 coming up next Sunday. Back here for the full podcast. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
So then we had at the very end of the show, a segment in the ring with Alexa Bliss and Randy Orton. She called him a bitch, which is their go-to word on these shows, right? Didn't we hear Kevin Owens call Roman Reigns the same thing on Friday night? He called him a bitch. Alexa Bliss here called Randy Orton a bitch. Boy, you know, I can play that game too. Hey, Vince McMahon, step aside, bitch. There, see how easy that was?
The Sala Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @SalaMonster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster sounds off.